Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else. The afterworld. A world of never-ending happiness. You can always see the sun. Day or night. So when you call up that shrink in Beverly Hills, you know the one. Dr. Everything will be all right. Sit him back to the moment of your time, my love. Ask him how much of your mind, baby. Cause in this life, things are much harder than the afterworld. This life, you're on your own.
I use Stevie Wonder as an inspiration, whom I look up to a great deal, just for the way that he crafted music and his connection to the spirit. And back then I used him as a role model in trying to play all the instruments and be very self-contained and keep my vision clear.
Prince talking to Larry King. Joining us shortly, another influence, Earth, Wind, and Fire's Verdeen White. Joining us right now is Stevie Wonder. Stevie, thank you so much for being with us. I'm sorry for the loss of your friend. When you heard first the news of his death this morning, what went through your mind?
Well, it's a heartbreak. And I was shocked. I didn't believe it. As I find it still hard to believe, you know, in this journey of music, we as artists that sort of create the reflection of society and reflect really the people that really want to see a better world, a better people, a unity of people, all those things, as did his music do, and will continue to do for those of us who will continue to listen to it. It's a heartbreak to lose a member of that army of love.
That army of love. The clip that Prince there we showed talking about you on Larry King, saying you were a role model for him, an inspiration to him, particularly when it came to playing his own instruments. I wonder, how did Prince influence you? How does he inspire you?
Well, he was a great musician. He loved music. He loved playing his instrument, and you know the times that we did jam together were amazing. With all the various people he would bring together, and most of all, he brought all the various cultures together. He could play classical music if he wanted to. He could play jazz if he wanted to. He could play country if he wanted to. He played rock, you know. He played blues. He played pop. He played, you know, everything. He was just a great musician, and very cognizant of what his responsibility was as a musician and a human being.
Today I was watching a recording of a concert that you did in Paris back in 2010. You were performing Superstition. Prince was accompanying you on the guitar, And what I think gets lost sometimes about Prince is, I mean, he wasn't just great, you know, songwriter. He was a stellar guitar player, and it wasn't just guitar. He played nearly all the instruments on all on his first five albums. I mean, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. And, you know, it's fun to do that because basically you're going inside yourself and you're really giving people every single part of what you feel. It's what your soul is saying. This is how I want this to be played. And fortunately, I can play it and express myself. It's like an artist painting a picture. So he was a great artist of picture, of sound picture and music. And so this is an amazing day as we see so many things happening. The heartbreak is to see this man who was so talented be taken away from us. But I know that you know, the Almighty God has far greater things for him to do eternally. So I just hope that we celebrate his music and celebrate his purpose that he fulfilled.
With that in mind, that idea of celebrating his music, I know you and Prince sang together at the White House last year. Is there a favorite song of yours? Is there something, I think you're near a piano, is there anything that comes to your heart, that comes to your head when, in terms of music, when you think of him?
You know, I love Purple Rain. I love the whole album. It was incredible. But I loved all the stuff that he did. You know, the song that I liked the whole album, but I think I liked Nikki Grind. It was like an interesting kind of song. And but again, as people I heard say earlier today on CNN, there was someone that said that he was able to mix the blessing of life of God and yet, you know, the marriage of sex and passion. So that's very, very true. He had fun doing it. And, you know, it's rare for me that I can feel, you know, with every single breath, how he just passionately loved music. It's like when musicians can jam, there's nothing like it in the whole world. I guess it's like when, you know, ball players are playing and they are excited about the game. Well, this is the same thing with us as musicians, to be able to say, okay, you can do that. I mean, let me watch me do this. And they can do that. I'll do that. It's just a lot of fun, and he was incredible with that.
Is there, I don't want to put you on the spot, is there any song you want to sing a little of or play a little of? Or, again, I don't want to put you on the spot if you're not up for it.
Yeah, I think I would probably break down.
Okay.
If I do a song right now. But, you know, he was incredible. And I'm just glad that I was able to say to him, I love you, the last time I saw him.
And he wrote a lot of songs for other artists over the years. And he was also a philanthropist, donated instruments for young musicians, was concerned about social justice issues, about, I mean, he did a lot of things for charity and didn't necessarily, you know, get his name associated with that. He did a lot of things anonymously.
Well, I think his spiritual commitment was far bigger than, you know, him having to say he did this and he did that. His commitment was in the action of what he did, not with the satisfaction of letting people know that he did it.
How do you, I mean, I don't know if I should even ask this question because it's maybe too soon to figure this out, and certainly we'll always have the music, but how do you hope people remember him?
Just a great musician, a great producer, great songwriter, someone that allowed himself to be himself and encouraged others to be themselves. And he was very free. And to do what he did without fear was a wonderful thing, because it's always great. It is always great when we don't allow fear to put our dreams to sleep. Mm. And he didn't.
Stevie Wonder, thank you so much. Again, I'm sorry we're talking under these circumstances, but it's always an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
But you know what's really significant about him you know, aside from the genius, was his activism. Like, he really walked around with the word slave on his face. And as a black American, he made me see that he understood his value, that he understood his worth, and he understood that the system, right? And so there's an activism in him. You know, he wrote a song about AIDS when no one was talking about AIDS. You know, Sign of the Times was a political song. So there's a part of him in all his intersections and diversity. There's a part of him that is very much an activist and very much. He was a prophet and a pimp and a protester and passionate. It was all of that.
From the black pool of genius, we'd like to give you our rendition of Stevie Wonder's Superwoman. Summer came, you were not around. Now the summer's gone and love cannot be found. Where were you and I? Last winter, my love.
While fans grieve over the loss of music icon Prince, there is a tribute to singer-musician Donny Hathaway about to open here in St. Louis. He is also described as a musical genius. Hathaway grew up in St. Louis and first came to national attention as a young man in 1970. 9 years later, he was dead at the age of 33. His life was complicated by mental illness. A portion of that life is the subject of a one-man play titled Twisted Melodies. It opens tonight at the Edison Theater at Washington University. Joining me in studio to talk about Twisted Melodies and Donny Hathaway are the playwright Kelvin Rostin Jr., who is also the star of this one-man play. Ron Himes is the founder and producing director of the St. Louis Black Repertory Theater, and Joe Yancey is executive director of Places for People, which helps people with mental health issues. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
It's thank good you. To be here,
thank
Don.
You. Thank you so much. Yeah.
I know you've had a couple of preview sessions of the play. They go well the last couple of nights?
Yes, we had previews on Wednesday and Thursday, and they went very, very well, and getting a lot of enthusiasm and involvement from the audiences.
Well, tonight is opening night for real, as they say, break a leg.
Thank you.
Kelvin, let me begin with you. Did you write this to honor Hathaway or to shine a light on mental illness?
Actually, both.
I knew you were going to say
yes.
That.
this play, Twisted Melodies, is actually an expansion of a play I wrote 9-10 years ago when I was still living here in St. Louis and working at the Black Repertory Company. That's where I got my professional start. And it was a play called Psychology of a Genius. And yes, it was written to honor Donny Hathaway. And, you know, my imagination of that last day. Fast forward some years, I grew up with mental illness in my family. So that's one of the attractions or one of the things that I was familiar with, which drew me to Donny Hathaway, as opposed to Stevie Wonder or Ray Charles.
Or Prince.
Or Prince, who are all musical geniuses. But it became apparent that, you know, this subject does need to be in the limelight. And so I already had something, took it apart, rewrote it, and tried to focus more on the mental illness at that point, mm-hmm. using Donny Hathaway.
Where do you pick up the story in his life? Is it the last day?
It is the last day. Yeah. It's so January 13th, 1979, starts in the studio, and then the rest of the show is in that hotel room.
What is there any music involved at all?
Oh, well, yeah, you couldn't do Donny Hathaway without having some music
Not sure how much music there might have been on that last day.
I understand. But he was in the studio. He was in the studio that last day and had a what we would call an episode, I guess, and they decided to stop the recording for that day to do it another day, but there was no another day.
He was schizophrenic, bipolar, is that?
Paranoid, schizophrenic, yes.
Right. Bad combination of things to happen. Ron Himes, what drew you to this? Obviously, it's a very dramatic show, a very dramatic story, but what drew you in particular to this?
Well, as Kelvin mentioned, he actually developed the original version of this show, The Psychology of a Genius, 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I started a series called the Standalone Series, and it was a series where I had challenged our interns and some of our staff to create one-person shows. Mm-hmm. And we had, out of that series, about 7 or 8 shows developed, and Psychology of a Genius would certainly rose to the top of the heap in terms of the work. It was really good work for all of the interns and staff that created these one-person pieces. All of them found out something about themselves. All of them grew a bit as artists. But the one that I could see that had the strongest seed or the richest kernel to grow and to have some greater fruition was The Psychology of a Genius. And we probably would have hopefully developed the piece here, but Kelvin had the opportunity to move to Chicago, and his career took off there, and he was fortunate enough to have a relationship with a theater in Chicago that invested in him developing the show further.
As you see the show, the same question that I asked Kelvin a moment ago, do you see it as a tribute to Donny Hathaway or more of a shining the light on the mental illness issue?
Well, I see it as both. I mean, I think that his initial show, The Psychology of a Genius, was certainly an homage. But I think that the work that he's done since he went back to revisit the script certainly shines a stronger light and a much stronger focus on Donnie's struggle with the schizophrenia and how the episode sort of led up to his ultimate suicide. When you asked about music in the show, I think one of the other things that he's done in the process of focusing on the schizophrenia is he's used a number of Donnie's songs and the lyrics in the songs to speak to the issues and the triggers that sort of set things off, set off episodes in that evening.
Before I turn to Joe Yancey, let me just go back to you with that, Kelvin. Mm-hmm. What is some of the music that you're using and some of those lyrics?
You know, I have snippets of Everything is Everything, parenthetical voices in my head. So, you know, he says, I hear voices, I see people. And mm-hmm. and of course, we can equate that to the political climate at the time. And I think it's all inclusive. But I also believe that that's one example of a musical genius using his music to talk about more than meets the eye, mm-hmm. if you will. And She Is My Lady, or More Than You'll Ever Know, I Love You More Than You'll Ever Know, some of those lyrics, and even some of the lyrics in The Closer I Get to You, you know, the closer I get to you, the more you make me see, you know, I use those to, you know, to try to push the point home that you need to listen close. You need to look close, and maybe you'll see more than just what's on the surface.
One of the other songs that I particularly like in the show is a cover that Donny Hathaway did of a John Lennon song, Jealous Guy. Mm-hmm. And so in that portion of the show, he talks about how he covers the John Lennon song, but how it meant something different to him, or how it affected him differently than it affected Lennon.
I have to assume that you're not doing any singing.
Oh, yes. Of course, I have to do that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, it sounds like it's a fun and yet important issue to deal with.
Absolutely.
Let me turn to Joe Yancey now and get your take on the value of a project like this in terms of educating people It would have to be an important contribution.
Don, I think it's critical. I think it's invaluable. It allows, within a safe space, an opportunity to get the conversation going, to start talking about the brain and the fact that the brain is part of the body. We don't separate that out, and at least we shouldn't. We have historically. But like any other part of the body, the brain can have problems as well. And too often we see people as weak, as there's something wrong with you. It's the only illness of the body where it's not, you know, you got a bad leg or your toe's broke. No, there's something wrong with you as a person. And getting that conversation going is critical because without good brain health and, you know, behavioral health, people are going to get sick physically as well.
How much progress have we made in recent years in educating people as to the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Well, I think we've made actually significant progress over the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years. It's important that we remember that it's not that long ago that the message was there's nothing we can do. We kept people in huge institutions. I mean, we're talking less than 60, 70 years ago. That is not a long amount of time. With the newer medications, with the newer technologies and treatment, with a significantly greater understanding of the brain and how that plays into not only mental illness but also addiction disorders and what have you, I think that we've made significant progress. And so when we talk about the play, it gives us an opportunity to have that conversation but to kind of bring it into the new age and talk about, you know, when Donnie went through what he went through, a lot of these new technologies and the hope for a person that has these illnesses didn't exist.
Ron Himes, what have you learned about all of this, given your exposure to this particular show?
You know, I've learned, again, you know, with a lot of the work we do, I learned how important it is for us to be able to present work that will facilitate these kinds of discussions. When Kelvin and I were able to lock in dates, one of the first things that I did was to call a former board member, Carl Wilson, who was at the Kreider Center for years. And I said, Carl, we're doing this play. I need to get in some contacts in the mental health community. Mm-hmm. I want to see if we can build a conversation around this play. And I think that I'm always looking for ways to select work that speaks to current and relevant issues in our community that will facilitate these kinds of conversations.
Is this show, is it one that young people, I mean very young people, could see, appreciate? I'm talking, you know, kids, young kids.
Well, actually, next Wednesday morning at 10 a.m., we'll do a school matinee. Uh-huh. And what we've said to the schools is that we're offering it for 6th through 12th grade. We were going to do younger, but we thought that, you know, with some of the resources in some of the schools, that might be a good place to begin that conversation and expose. So we're doing a student mandate for 6th through 12th grade next year.
Next Wednesday,
I mean. Yep. And I just had gotten to notice that Dr. Tandon over at Children's Hospital just wrote a book on children and mental illness. Mm-hmm. And I tried to get her to come in to facilitate the post-show discussion with the students, but she's in she has appointments all that day. But she has made a commitment to come out, and we're going to try to convene a group of younger children, younger than sixth grade, when she'll come in with her book and read the book to them and have conversations about mental health with what we're hoping will be maybe 5-6-year-olds up to fifth grade.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you're losing. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
I think it's a lot of black young kids is going through this.
This idea sort of developed that children in school could be dangerous.
The first time she got suspended, I want to say it was maybe within the first month of school starting. And I'm like, wow, how can you don't even know the kids yet.
Irrespective of the age of the kid, the behaviors what we all concerned about.
My understanding of myself was that I was a bad kid.
I had a lot who were pre-K and kindergartners, like they were just getting ready to go into kindergarten and first grade, who was like, yeah, I got suspended. Me too. And so really you have to begin to say, is the problem the student or is the problem the system?
That's just a sampling of what we heard while reporting on racial disparities in student suspensions. Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim.
And if you've listened to our past work, then you already know there are countless examples across the country where data show when it comes to school discipline, all kids are not being treated equally.
In Missouri, this is especially true for black students, who get 40% of the suspensions, yet only make up 16% of the student population.
And when a kid gets suspended in these early grades, when they're 5, 6, 7 years old, it can put them into what's called the school-to-prison pipeline. And across the country, there's a growing movement to cut off that pipeline before it gets started.
Locally, the Ferguson Commission recommended a ban on out-of-school suspensions in kindergarten through third grade. As it stands, that decision would have to be made by individual school boards. Yet, here's what Missouri's Education Commissioner, Margie Van Deven, told us last fall when I asked her about whether or not students in kindergarten through third grade should be getting out-of-school suspensions.
Now, I personally do not believe that they should be getting out-of-school suspensions.
But they are. And according to our analysis, it's happening to students of color a lot. If you spend enough time with state data, a picture starts to emerge, and it's this.
In Missouri, when white kids in these early grades act out, they get kicked out of class. But the black kids, they get kicked out of school.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems, and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
So on this show, we're going to get into all sorts of data, talk to some experts, and we'll see how this is playing out in other parts of the country.
But first, we wanted you to meet Kiana Fields and her son, Johnny. It's early in the morning, and Kiana is running the comb through Johnny's hair.
You gonna have a good day at school today?
Yes.
Okay. Kiana lives in a tiny little brick home about a mile from the Mississippi River on St. Louis's north side, and her 8-year-old son, Johnny, is a second grader at Nance Elementary.
So, Johnny, what's your favorite thing to learn about in school right now?
Math, spelling words, and, like, learning new books.
Yeah, tell me about your grades this year. I hear you're doing pretty good.
Really good about my grades. I got a lot of S's.
And you were what?
Be on the road.
How's that make you feel to be on the honor roll? That's pretty cool.
It makes me feel like I'm a good student, a smart student. Felt great because I thought I wasn't going to get on the road. That I have been doing good instead of doing bad, I thought I'm proud of myself.
That feels probably pretty good, Mom.
That's going to make me cry.
No, don't cry.
Okay, I'm not. Once I cry, it's what? Happy?
Cheers.
Almost as soon as Kiana finishes bundling Johnny up in a coat, he darts out the door and makes a beeline for his bus stop.
He ready to leave me. I'm like, oh, damn, baby. Have a good day. Can I tell you, have a good day? Can I catch you? See how he is so happy to go to school this year. And last year, he missed 38 days. So just think, as a child, how he feels so much better, happy this year.
38 days. Let that sink in.
That's basically 2 months out of school.
Not because Johnny was sick, not because Kiana was homeless and going from place to place. It was a choice made by school administrators.
Back in the living room of her home, Kiana pulls out a well-worn manila folder that's stuffed with school records.
Right here where you can see. And he got suspended right behind it.
There's paperwork for all the 1-day, 2-day, 5-day, and even 10-day out-of-school suspensions.
It was so, so hard because I was like, this is messing with my baby life.
Kiana knows her son can be a handful. He first started acting out near the end of kindergarten, overturning desks and fighting with other students.
Kiana doesn't dispute that those things happened, but the response from school administrators seemed way too harsh. She says the school even tried to bar Johnny from his kindergarten graduation.
Yeah, I told them that's not right. No. So they did let him go to the kindergarten graduation, but they had him like back. You couldn't even see him. He was like in the back of the row.
She thought maybe this was a phase, but it wasn't. When he got to first grade last year, Johnny kept acting out in class, and the suspensions got longer and longer.
And he started saying things like, I want to kill myself, I hate this school, I wish I'd die. And it was like he was crying out for help.
Just to be clear, like along the way, nobody with the school said, you should go see a psychologist. Nobody said, let's try and diagnose what these issues are.
No, I was the only one. Something inside of me said, you know what? You need to go get your baby some help. Go see a psychiatrist. Something just told me, go and take him to get help.
A doctor diagnosed Johnny with ADHD and depression, but the out-of-school suspensions kept coming.
It was just so, it was hurtful. I had to go to the library because I had to be the teacher. I did not give up. That's why he wasn't behind academic. We went to the library. I requested work.
Keeping Johnny on track academically wasn't Kiana's only concern. At one point, the Department of Social Services calls Kiana to say they're investigating a child abuse complaint against Johnny's assistant principal.
According to state documents, the school administrator dragged Johnny down the hall by his hoodie after he had an outburst in class. Johnny, witnesses said, told the assistant principal she was choking him and asked her to stop dragging him. But because he had no physical injuries and because he was, quote, out of control, the State Department determined the incident didn't rise to the level of abuse.
The assistant principal is no longer with the district. As the suspensions continued, Johnny's psychologist told Kiana to go see an attorney.
When she saw them days after 38 days, she said, I'm taking your case. I'm going to help you. And then I started crying. I cried. And when she saw me crying, she said, I'm going to help you. I said, please help me. I said, I don't want my baby to be stupid.
The lawyer Kiana went to go see helped Johnny get something called a 504 plan.
That's an agreement that says a school has to make sure a student with a disability gets a fair education. This often means that educators have to make special accommodations for a student who has a diagnosis like ADHD or depression.
And Kiana says after this, things got a lot better. Her son now sees a therapist from both the school district and a social service agency. There's a new principal at the school. And Kiana says this year, Johnny's teacher goes out of her way to help him cope with mood swings.
Because even though he have ADHD and a behavior problem, doesn't stop you. Doesn't stop your academic. But what stops your academic is you out of school. If you're out of school, you're not doing any work. I think it's a lot of black young kids is going through this where these schools are suspending these kids and they not getting their education.
She's right. It's confirmed in the state data we analyzed over the past couple of months.
So this is where we ask you to indulge us a little as we tunnel through some of our findings. And if you don't have a notepad to jot these numbers down, don't worry. You can find a complete list at our website, welivehere.show.
All right, let's get started. Last year, educators in Missouri issued about 21,500 in and out of school suspensions to students in kindergarten through third grade. The majority of those suspensions went to black students.
What's more, our analysis found black students are far more likely to get out-of-school suspensions than their white classmates. Last year, 70% of all out-of-school suspensions went to black students, even though they make up just 17% of the state's kindergarten through third grade students.
And this is a really, really important point. This disparity means that black students are losing much more learning time than their white counterparts.
So, to recap, here are the two big data points you need to remember. A, white kids don't get as many suspensions.
And B, black kids are far more likely to get out-of-school suspensions. St. Louis Public Schools, the district that runs Johnny's elementary school, sits atop this trend. So we sat down with Superintendent Kelvin Adams and asked him to explain the numbers.
I think it's frustrating, but I don't want to make an excuse. I will own the fact that we have to do a better job around finding resources to support kids in grades kindergarten, first and second and third.
According to state data, last year the district issued 857 out-of-school suspensions to kids in kindergarten through third grade. Not one went to a white student. And in recent years, that's not unusual.
Since 2008, 273 out-of-school suspensions went to white kids in those grades, compared to 10,580 for black kids. Part of this is because of the demographics of the district, which is predominantly black. And Adam says when he took over the Long Trouble District 8 years ago, he was focused on other things.
Obviously, when I took over the district, it was unaccredited. It was also bleeding and hemorrhaging financially. And there was some issues around governance. And we've concentrated our efforts on those three main issues. And sometimes in looking at the big picture, you don't look really in a detailed way around something like suspensions.
But Adams says that changed after Ferguson. There was also a well-publicized national report that found the district's suspension rate for black students was among the highest in the country.
As we've gotten deeper in this work over the last, especially 3 years, we've been looking closely at discipline data to the extent that we have moved the needle downward. But to the extent that it needs to be, if one kid is suspended grades K through 3, it's one too many.
Adams says he now looks at discipline data every week.
And we should note that St. Louis Public Schools has seen a significant drop in the number of total suspensions, both in and out of school, compared to 5 years ago.
But Adams says it's been a struggle to come up with a widespread plan that provides all the emotional and behavioral support their students sometimes need.
My teachers are telling me, and my administrators, quite frankly, are telling me in elementary schools that they're seeing behaviors that they've never seen before. Students out of control who need assistance, who need counseling, who need therapy. We opened a therapeutic school this year. Cost us about $1 million to do so. So we are looking for solutions to solve the problem. The question becomes for us is the problem overwhelming for us, or do we need additional resources to address that problem?
Adams says roughly half of the district's 46 elementary schools don't have the resources to provide in-school suspensions on a regular basis.
So in some of our elementary schools, especially the small ones, they may have a social worker 1 day a week. They may have a counselor 1 day a week. They may have a nurse 1 day a week. Those schools that have numbers around 400 or 500 get full-time staff in those areas, but most of them don't have that support to accommodate those kids.
Nevertheless, Adams says the district is taking steps to reduce suspensions in the early grades.
There's a pilot program at 7 elementary schools where teachers are being trained on how to recognize their own implicit racial biases.
The district also is reviewing its code of conduct to reduce the number of students being suspended for discretionary things like disrespecting a teacher.
But even with that, I want to be clear that we still need to have supports for kids when they where they don't act appropriately in the school environment, because we do have to take some kind of action, the Safe School Act. And I keep saying it like a broken record, we do have to take some kind of action.
When educators like Adams talk about school safety as a reason for suspensions, it makes people like Luz Enriquez squirm.
I hear that a lot is, you know, we need to keep our other children here safe. And I'm not disputing that it is the school's job to keep the other children safe. I just don't see if they are achieving that goal by putting this child out.
Luce is an attorney at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri and represents families of suspended students across the St. Louis region.
She says the rise in the use of school suspensions runs parallel to the Get Tough on Crime movement from the 90s.
And concerns about safety ratcheted up after the Columbine school shooting in 1999.
This idea sort of developed that children in school could be dangerous.
But Luz says many of the kids she represents aren't getting in trouble for doing something really dangerous, like bringing a gun to school. Instead, she says, families turn to her when they feel like the schools are doing more harm than good.
I can tell you of one situation in particular that sticks to mind, where the parent came to me in, I want to say, end of October. So the school year starts in August. End of October, the parent came to me and said, well, this is, you know, my child's third 10-day suspension. So at that point in time, the child...
30 days.
Yeah, had essentially been out of school.
What were they suspended for?
They always classify it as somewhat different, but it's usually like the disruption. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they try to categorize it as assault. It's really when this six-year-old boy was having outbursts and throwing desks upside down and throwing papers on the floor. And, you know, they would say, you know, vandalism, like
So it's these like criminal terms that get applied to 5 and 6 year old. All of a sudden, if a kid throws a desk, it's not the
it's assault.
Yes,
or vandalism. Or something.
Very. The terms that they use sometimes, I always think, well, yes, he or you know, if they hit a teacher, they'll try to call it assault on a teacher. Under the code of conduct, they have those definitions, so they're separate. They're not the criminal definitions, but they're the same terms that they try to use. And I think the mindset is it's very similar to the criminal term. When in reality, he, in my opinion, he needed additional services that were not being met at the time.
Luce says she sees lots of these cases, and she doubts state numbers tell the whole story. Many times, Luce says, schools issue what she calls de facto suspensions.
This is when kids are sent home, but no suspension is recorded. Either way, Luce says, the results can be devastating.
Children are intelligent. They know that they can pick up on the fact that they are not wanted and that they are seen as bad apples or the troublemakers. And I think that just continues to perpetuate the internal stereotypes of the expectations that child is expected to live up to, and the stereotypes among the district folks and the teachers about what they expect of that child.
His girlfriend came across a needle and soon she did the same. At home there were 17-year-old boys and their idea of fun is being in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack, toting a machine gun.
We begin today's show here in New York, where the family of an unarmed man killed by a police officer is reacting to news that the officer will serve no time in jail. In 2014, New York City police officer Peter Liang fatally shot Akai Gurley in the darkened stairwell of a Brooklyn housing project. Gurley, a 28-year-old African-American father, was walking down the stairs with his girlfriend because the elevator was broken. Liang says he accidentally fired his gun. The bullet ricocheted off a wall and struck Gurley in the chest. Following the shooting, Officer Liang first texted his union representative before making a radio call for help as Gurley lay dying. New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton called Gurley a, quote, total innocent.
The Liang case has sparked a debate within the Asian American community. Some believe he was scapegoated because of his race. Others stand by the family of Akai Gurley. For more, we're joined right now in New York by three guests. Hortensia Peterson is the aunt of Akai. Kathy Dang is executive director of CAV, Organizing Asian Communities, which supports Akai Gurley's family. And John Liu is a former New York City comptroller and professor of public finance at CUNY and Columbia University. He's been working with supporters of Peter Liang. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! First to Hortensia Peterson. Our condolences on the death of your nephew, of Akai Gurley. This happened back in November of 2014. Hortensia Peterson, can you explain what you understand happened that day?
What I understand happened is that my nephew was basically walking down a flight of steps, leaving the building. And because the elevator was broken, Peter Liang fired a shot. It ricocheted. And Akai...
Why did he fire the shot?
Because he's saying that he was afraid. He heard a noise. And my question has and will always be, if you're going into a development and, you know, families live there, So why would you enter a dark stairwell with your gun drawn, with your finger on the trigger? 9 times out of 10, there's an error that's going to happen. Someone can get hurt. It could have been a child, a grandmother, a mother. It could have been anyone. And on top of that, he had a flashlight. What happened to using that flashlight? You don't enter a dark stairwell with a gun drawn. A flashlight is sufficient. He asked his partner for light. So why would you have your finger on the trigger?
So do you believe, Hortensia, that there's any truth to Liang's claim that the gun actually, he accidentally shot the gun? In other words, he didn't intend to.
No. First of all, guns don't discharge by themselves. You have to apply at least 11 and a half pounds of pressure. You have to. It does not go off by itself. So, no, I do not believe it was an accident.
And Kathy Dang, can you talk about why your organization, CAV, has stood with the family of Akai Gurley, even though a number of Asian American organizations have been protesting on behalf of Peter Liang?
Well, our organization started 30 years ago out of supporting Asian immigrants and refugees who were impacted by police and hate violence. And we stood firm that we had to address issues and root causes of violence that impact communities of color that's perpetuated by the state and by the police. And police continue to carry on with being held accountable. We couldn't let that happen in this case. And we got involved because we didn't want race to be the reason why Peter Liang wasn't held accountable. At the end of the day, he has a uniform and he's an officer, and he needs to be held accountable.
Professor John Liu, your response.
John Liu.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for having me on this show. This is a very complex case. It does not fit neatly into what people typically see as a black-white model of race relations. I guess you had introduced me earlier as a supporter of Peter Liang. I wouldn't quite characterize it that way. I've never met Peter Liang. I don't know him. But I do agree with many Asian Americans in New York and beyond. And you can see from the tens of thousands of people who actually protested the initial verdict of manslaughter that Peter Liang was being scapegoated, being blamed for all of the criminal justice ills that have gone wrong in this country. And so people in the Asian American community really do sympathize with the family of Akai Gurley, his aunt here. There's nobody who's against Akai and his family. No one's saying that his life was meaningless. In fact, you know, he's a young man who held promise and was trying to do the right thing. But at the same time, you also have a feeling in the Asian American community that that Liang was just that too much was put on him. That, you know, in the trial, the DA actually talked about how this was not about criminal justice in the rest of the country. It was not about the NYPD. It was just about Liang. And so, how can this be about holding the entire system accountable when it seems like it's all just about holding this one officer accountable, NYPD being held harmless, NYCHA, which is the agency that runs the building that allowed there to be complete darkness in the stairwell, they're held harmless. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's about holding police officers accountable. And Asian American leaders in the community at large are not saying that Peter Liang is innocent. He was convicted of official misconduct, which represents or reflects the fact that he just didn't do anything to help Akai Gurley. He may have shot him accidentally. The gun might have discharged because he was startled by a noise in a dark situation, but he should have done more. So people, you know, don't dispute the fact that he was indicted, that he was convicted of official misconduct, and he is now sentenced, not jail time, but he does have a pretty long sentence. This is far more than we have seen in any other case in recent memory. Eric Garner being choked to death by a police officer, not even an indictment in that case. Michael Brown, so many other cases in New York and across the country. Timothy Stansbury in New York City, which was a case almost identical in circumstances. nothing in that case, no actions against the officer. None of these officers have even been fired from their jobs. So Peter Liang has been sentenced, and he is being punished and held accountable. It's just a question of to what extent do you hold him accountable? Do you hold him accountable for his actions that day, or do you hold him accountable for all the other cases that didn't see any kind of justice whatsoever?
Hortensia Peterson, your response to what Professor Liu said.
My response to you is, number one, from the time the trial began, you have been in the courtroom with Peter Liang. Number two, if this was your child, your nephew, would you not want justice? Number three, you reference Eric Gardner, Amadou Diallo, Timothy Stansberry. The list is long. Where was the Asian community? Where was the Chinese community? Where were they? On top of that, what happened to Nicholas Haywood Jr.? The same exact story, the same exact excuse. When you have a corrupted system with police officers are being protected by the law, the ending result is Akai Gurley. We have been trying to prevent this from 22 years ago. And let's take it to NYCHR. Peter Liang and Sean Lundell, that was not the first time they have been doing vertical patrol in the pink houses. That was their daily, nightly post. Number one, they knew the area. Number two, because you're not going to sit here and try to justify why Peter Liang should not be held accountable. First of all, he is part of the system, the entire system. It's a systematic problem. We have told and have said plenty of time it's all about accountability. Yes, in Staten Island, the Eric Gardner, if you have a prosecutor that does not care about what goes on in his community and is racist, that's the result you will have. Now, let's take it to Ferguson. The same scenario. If you have a prosecutor that don't care about the people that put them in position, this is what you will have. So here it is now. My nephew, Akai Gurley, Sylvia Palmer, Akaila Gurley, is without a son, a father, a nephew, and a brother. So, yes, Peter Liang should be held accountable, because if it was your child, if it was your mother, your father, or any one of your loved ones, you would want justice. You would want, my definition of justice and yours is totally different. On top of that, February 20th, 2016, there was massive rallies nationwide saying injustice, injustice. Peter Liang was not a scapegoat. Peter Liang is part of the problem. Every last one of those Asians and Chinese supporters, because you are also part of the problem, you helped back and finance. You understand? You guys got together. And here it is. You're saying it's okay. When I walked downtown Brooklyn February 20th, I was called a nigger.
Nigger!
Do you understand? After giving solidarity to the family, the family's there in the flesh, I was disrespected. So it's no way you can tell me. We are all people of color. All people of color. If we have to get together, and this is what the Justice for Akai Gurley family and every grassroots CAV, everyone has been saying, let's not make this a race issue. We're all human. That fatal night, Akai Gurley, Peter Liang, he heard a sound. Sean Landau didn't hear that sound.
Peter, you know, I think no matter how many apologies you can give, you can't bring back the life of Akai for the family. And it's painful for me to sit alongside Auntie, the Palmer's parents, Kim and his children. And, you know, I just can't understand if any other average person out there can apologize and would still have to go to jail for committing accidental manslaughter or accidental death, accidental killing. That's what manslaughter is. They would go to jail. So, and even if they apologize, so why should Liang be treated any differently than anybody else?
And what about the argument that people make that it's because he was Asian American that he's been charged, whereas all the white police officers who were responsible for the deaths of African Americans were exonerated?
And I keep hearing again and again that he's being used as a scapegoat. A scapegoat is someone who doesn't do anything wrong or didn't do anything wrong. And in this case, he did do something wrong. He killed Akai Gurley, and he needs to be punished for that, not just held accountable. He needs to be punished and serve jail time. And from the beginning, we've said this case means that we need to stand united to hold white officers accountable. What about the district attorneys like Don Donovan, who didn't indict Dan Pantaleo for the murder of Eric Garner? We need to make sure the DAs are doing their job across the city. We want a special prosecutor in New York State to investigate all the killings in New York State. And, you know, this is the testament to how our communities can come together to address something larger. We will never know, as Asian Americans, what it's like to lose a life every 28 hours, like the black community does in the United States. And what I do want to raise is that when we talk about structural racism, white supremacy, and anti-blackness, we have to admit that Asian Americans are complicit and complacent to uphold white supremacy. And we are responsible in making sure that we stand together with black communities to bring down white supremacy and structural racism. That's the only way to win for all of us. All of our lives will matter when black lives matter.
You turn on the telly and every other story is telling you somebody died. Sister killed a baby because she couldn't afford to feed it. We're sending people to the moon. September, my cousin tried reefer for the very first time. Now he's doing horse. It's June.
The question's been asked for nearly a year now. When will someone be held accountable for lead contamination of Flint's drinking water? Now, three people are being charged with crimes. Two state water quality experts and Flint's water quality supervisor are accused of misconduct, neglect of duty, and falsifying the results of tests to hide the fact the city's drinking water was contaminated. Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette says these were public officials who had a responsibility to ensure clean and safe drinking water.
They failed. They failed to discharge their duties. They failed. They failed in their responsibilities to protect the health and safety of families of Flint. They failed Michigan families. Indeed, they failed us all, and I don't care where you live.
To gauge how people in Flint are reacting to this news, we now check in with Janaea McDonald. She's a Flint resident, a substitute teacher, mother of two young boys, Justice and Josiah, and she joins us on a cell phone. It's good to have you back.
Thanks, Robert.
How did you learn about the charges today, and what was your reaction?
Well, I was at school doing a class today, but I took a break to go back and kind of listen and hear. It's kind of bittersweet. I feel like it's about time, but there is absolutely a lot more that needs to be done.
Does charging state and local officials with crimes related to the water crisis, does it help restore your trust in the government at all?
Not at all. No. The only thing that will install my trust back in the local government here, as far as city and statewide, is to see these pipes replaced. It's happening slow motion. It's not happening in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But that is the only thing that I feel would make it right.
I asked you about trust in the government. Of course, the other issue here is trust in the water. What are you doing now in terms of water in the household, and what would give you confidence in the water coming out of the tap?
I do not use the tap water for anything we put in our mouths. I clean with it. Unfortunately, I started bathing in it. I didn't have much choice. We do not put the boys in the tap water still. We still boil bottled water for them. I do not cook with the tap water, even with the filter that's on my faucet. I will not use that water to ingest.
Well, quite apart from the replacement of pipes, if there are indeed going to be more criminal charges brought against more people, as the Attorney General said today that there will be, will that in some way contribute to your sense of justice being done over the Flint water crisis?
Absolutely, and I will feel a complete sense of justice once he filed charges against our governor, because ultimately he is the parent of Michigan, and we are his children as residents of Michigan. And you as a parent have failed your children, and you need to be responsible for us, and you need to be held accountable for us. And just because I'm one of your children that live in the bad part of your house does not mean I'm not an important child, because Flint is, they're saying poor, but we have no jobs, we have high crime. Because of that, here in this city, I feel like enough is not being done fast enough, loud enough, or soon enough.
And just before you go, I should ask, how are your boys, how are Justice and Josiah doing?
Josiah has been diagnosed with autism. We have been waiting on that diagnosis. So it's a whole other ballgame for me now. There is no maybe. My son is autistic, and I'm having to fight to get my son services that he deserves and not the services that they just want to pacify me with. Justice, he's doing better. He's doing a lot better now that I'm not bathing him in that water. His rashes are clearing up, so they're doing better.
That's Janaea McDonald, a Flint teacher and mother of two. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
U.S. Secretary of State Jack Lew has announced the new $20 bills will feature iconic abolitionist Harriet Tubman on the front, replacing former president and slave owner Andrew Jackson.
Harriet Tubman is one of the great American stories. A woman born a slave, illiterate for her whole life. She brought many, many people out of slavery through the Underground Railroad by time and again risking her own life to save others. She did intelligence for our army during the Civil War. After she worked to get the women's suffrage movement going. It's a great American story.
That was U.S. Treasury Secretary Jack Lew. The move comes after more than a half a million people voted for Harriet Tubman to replace Jackson. But in fact, President Jackson will not be removed entirely, simply moved to the back of the bill. Some have criticized the idea that Harriet Tubman should represent U.S. currency at all. In a 2015 essay that went viral again yesterday, the writer Feminista Jones wrote, quote, "If having Harriet Tubman's face on the $20 bill was going to improve women's access to said bill, I'd be all for it. But instead, it only promises to distort Tubman's legacy rooted in resisting the foundation of American capitalism." Well, for more, we're joined by two guests. In New York, Stephen Thrasher is with us. He's a weekly columnist for The Guardian U.S., where he wrote a piece headlined, "To Put Harriet Tubman and the $20 Bill Would Be an Insult to Her Legacy." Here in Denver, we're joined by Winston Grady Willis. He is professor and chair of Africana Studies at Metropolitan State University here in Denver. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! We're going to start with the professor here in Denver, Colorado. Professor, talk about who Harriet Tubman was. Give us a thumbnail sketch of this remarkable woman's life.
Thank you, Amy. She was a remarkable woman indeed. She was born into slavery in Maryland. She was initially slated to work in the big house, but was seen as being too recalcitrant, and so was placed in the field, which is the experience for the large number of enslaved African women and men. She
was born in 1822 in the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
In Maryland, she would eventually escape from slavery, but realize that her own individual freedom from chattel slavery simply was not enough. And so she dedicated the rest of her life to this ongoing mission to free family members, friends, individuals who did not know her directly. She became the most prominent conductor with the Underground Railroad.
I mean, it's interesting. She escaped slavery like 10 years after Frederick Douglass from the same area
right.
he also enslaved.
Right.
He goes north, becomes a world-renowned speaker against slavery.
Yes.
But she comes back to the place where she had been brutalized,
That's right?
They said she experienced these epileptic-like seizures because she had been beaten so badly around her head.
That's right. And she would live with this lifelong disability, yet help empower individuals to escape from slavery. And the key thing, the relationship between Douglass and Tubman, Douglass, along with Sojourner Truth, are quintessential examples of political abolitionists. And Tubman is what I would call a military abolitionist. Many folks would refer to her as Moses, but a number of enslaved Africans, others in the Underground Railroad, often refer to her as the general.
And talk about, she not only was a conductor, as they say, on the Underground Railroad, coming back, freeing hundreds of slaves, but she fought in the Civil War.
She did indeed. She was a spy, she was a scout, and most famously, perhaps, she was the individual who led the raid down the Combahee River in the low country of South Carolina. It was a nighttime raid in which she led forces that U.S. Army forces, often referred to as Union forces, who freed dozens of enslaved Africans, eventually hundreds, under Confederate fire. Not a single individual was lost.
Afterwards, after her position fighting in the Civil War, it took her decades to get a pension.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
Absolutely. It was a decades-long struggle, and then when she finally did receive that pension, it was an absolute pittance. There's no question about it.
And slave owners put a bounty on her head?
Yes, absolutely. I often think of, when we think of the bounty that Assata Shakur has on her head, I'm reminded that there's a long tradition of individuals going back to Tubman herself who were deemed such a threat to the status quo.
Stephen Thrasher, you wrote about Harriet Tubman replacing the slave-owning president, Andrew Jackson, on the front of the bill. He'll be pushed to the back of the bill. Your thoughts on this iconic abolitionist, her face on the most used bill in the United States?
I had very mixed feelings about it, and I don't disagree with anything the professor said about what a fantastic and wonderful American she was. And I do understand people who think that this is an opportunity to have her have more visibility. But I'm really concerned about it because Harriet Tubman was, you know, a slave herself. She could have been bought or sold with a $20 bill. And her work was about undoing the system of oppression of African Americans. And so I really worry that in being placed on the bill, that will be sort of a way of papering over her true legacy and sort of be a way to just say that things are being taken care of and are no longer problematic. I would be entirely for the Harriet Tubman Reparations Act of 2016. You know, if I know this Congress would never pass such a thing and President Obama probably wouldn't sign it. But I'd be all for having something happen where Harriet Tubman was used to address the economic inequality of African Americans still to this day. But I'm really worried about seeing her face on this bill, starting to see her face on mattress sales or, you know, electronic store sales or things like that, and just seeing the American dollar, you know, consume one of our heroes who is really about undoing the ways that American capitalism used our bodies to capitalize this country.
I wanted to read you a quote from NPR pointing out that putting Tubman on the $20 bill would be poetic because of a special historical resonance that's the same amount she eventually received from the U.S. government as her monthly pension for her service as a nurse, scout, cook, and spy during the Civil War, as well as her role as for her status as the widow of a veteran. Stephen Thrasher, your response.
I would be more persuaded that that was useful now if we were at a place where African Americans and African American women were earning, you know, equal pay and had equal wealth. But the fact of the matter is that right now, white families have about 12 times the wealth of black families in this country. Black women earn something like 64 cents on the dollar to white men. And so we're still living in a time that over the course of decades and centuries has been created an economic inequality from the time that Harriet Tubman was doing her work. And these things haven't been addressed. You know, we have, of course, racial disparities that happen across millions of people. But there's specific companies like, as I wrote in my piece, Aetna Insurance, that they insured slaves, they made their money off of slaves, they made their wealth off of slaves, that very much fueled the economy of this nation for hundreds of years. And that led to these disparities that we still have. And those specific things are not being addressed. So to then take Harriet Tubman, one of our best images and one of our best people who was fighting that, and then to now put her on the dollar that is still economically oppressing black people, I think really misses a very important point.
Professor Winston Grady Willis, this whole issue of her representing mm-hmm. capitalism.
Yes. I think that Stephen Thrasher makes a really important point. His piece is excellent, and he and a number of other individuals, political prisoner, freedom fighter, Jahlil Montequin, make very, very important points here. And so in many ways, I'm actually in agreement. But at the end of the day, perhaps it's the practical bones in my body. I think that having Tubman as the face on the $20 bill actually provides an opportunity for a number of us to go beyond an elementary school narrative and discussion of her life and legacy. She is an extraordinary figure. And given the place of enslaved African men and women, and specifically the marginalization of enslaved African women, the absolute absence of ownership over their bodies, Tubman's activism, Her agency stands in stark contrast to that. And I think it's very, very important for folks to not only understand that, but to also, in a society in which heroism, when connected, when gendered, when seen in connection to womanhood, is often always placed in exclusively white terms, to have Tubman given prominence in this way is profoundly important.
Seems like the only thing that he can do is just roll his eyes and say,
The life expectancy of white women has declined by about a month, and black men are living about a half a year longer. That's the headline out of a new report today from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And NPR's Allison Kojak reports the numbers are a simple take on much more complex health and economic issues.
The report is just a few pages long with some bar graphs and numbers. But behind that data is a complex picture of economic inequality and even despair. The first piece, the life expectancy of white women fell by about 1 month. It's the first decline in life expectancy for white women since the agency started keeping records almost 100 years ago. Elizabeth Arias wrote the report and was troubled, so she looked deeper.
The increases in causes of death that affected this change negatively were unintentional injuries, suicide, and chronic liver disease.
Those unintentional injuries are basically drug overdoses, and chronic liver disease comes with alcoholism. The numbers echo the findings of a major study out of Princeton last fall that showed more and more white people are dying in middle age of the same causes. Anne Case, an economist and lead author of that earlier study, called them deaths of despair.
What looks like people are killing themselves either quickly or slowly. Quickly is either suicide, drug overdose, or slowly is with alcohol-related diseases.
Case says her research shows that those deaths are concentrated among white people with less education, high school dropouts, and people who never went to college. She suspects the reasons are tied to their diminished economic prospects.
It's possible that working-class whites lost the narrative of their lives, that they, with a high school degree, could get a job, with on-the-job training, with benefits. They could see the possibility that their children's lives would be richer than their own.
And expectations may be the key difference between white women, whose life expectancy fell in the CDC study, and black men, whose rose by almost half a year.
For African Americans, I mean, they have been dealing with economic challenges. It's not that things are great for African Americans, but we deal with economic challenges all the time.
That's David Williams, a sociologist at Harvard who has studied the impact of race and income on health.
What's new is for many whites who are not now experiencing the economic well-being that they were raised to believe that they would have. It is challenging and it is very difficult, and there are emotional consequences that manifest themselves in physical illness.
Suicides and other so-called deaths of despair are on the decline among black men and women. Still, Williams stresses that even if black men's outlook continues to improve at today's fast clip, it will take two decades for them to catch up with white women.
It's important to realize that although the life expectancy declining for white women, that white women nonetheless are still living almost 10 years longer than African-American men. So there still is a large racial gap in health.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
All right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
Even if black men's outlook continues to improve at today's fast clip, it will take two decades for them to catch up with white women.
It's important to realize that although the life expectancy declining for white women, that white women nonetheless are still living almost 10 years longer than African-American men. So there still is a large racial gap in health.
And that gap is even wider with Hispanic men and women. The CDC report shows they live longer than everyone else. Allison Kojak, NPR News.
Long life, but we all live more than long life will come to pass. Show.
context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 23rd, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Feel free, dial in if you have thoughts you would like to share. Lots of things happened this past week. Number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We will get to workplace racism down the road. Sure, folks have quite a bit to discuss. This was another week where there were larger, lengthier news clips. There were a lot of audio clips and things that happened that I was not even able to include. Certainly, first and foremost, I know down through the years that we've had quite a few listeners in the Houston, Texas area. I've been to Houston myself. Certainly, thoughts and prayers go out to all the folks that are down there that are having any difficulties with the flooding. I was stunned. I saw some of the video footage, and I didn't know if they were showing Houston or if they were showing archival footage from Hurricane Katrina. It looked exactly, and I mean painfully, similar to Hurricane Katrina in 2005. But I know that was certainly big news, and again, thoughts and prayers to folks that are in that area. The situation with Flint, where they pressed charges against three officials, not Governor Rick Snyder, one of the black females, black mothers, who was one of the first to sue about the poisoning, chemical warfare that is happening in Flint, Michigan, surprisingly ended up dead, shot dead, in fact, under suspicious circumstances. I thought that was extremely important. I had that as well, just didn't have time to play everything. Anders Breivik, the white terrorist in Norway who killed nearly 80 people with the explosion, the bomb that he detonated, and then just going out and shooting folks at random, unarmed people, because of his fury about too many non-white people. Islamization was the term he used. He won a court case saying that his human rights were being violated this week because apparently they say he's being kept in isolation. He's not in the general population in Norway. Stunning turn of events for this white man. Had a clip on that, just was not able to include everything. This was not a good week to not be paying attention to what happened in the news, because it was very easy to kind of get caught up the beginning of the week with the New York primary, and then the latter part of the week with the death of Prince. It was very easy to miss a lot of other things that happened globally related to racism, white supremacy. With that, we will get to the phone lines. If you could take 5 minutes to make your comments, observations, whatever you would like to share. 5 minutes. I'll try to make sure I prompt folks when your time is up, just that way we can get as many people in to share their thoughts, observations as possible. Ask again, no metaphors. I don't, you know, say that just to be saying it. I'm sure there are some people who, you know, Gus, you are crazy on many things. This is just another one where you are talking nonsense. But I do ask we not use metaphors, and it's only this program. This is not something where I've said, you know, you can't use metaphors on the cows at all. I've only said for the compensatory call-in, it would be great if we could not use metaphors, just be explicit, specific, clear, and direct about what it is that we're talking about. It's been my experience that frequently a lot of times we use metaphors. It is not adding clarity to what is being presented. Frequently, the metaphors are comparing two things that are not similar at all. When we're talking about racism, white supremacy, there are a variety of problems that pop up when people start employing a lot of analogies and metaphors. I get it that sometimes people just want a quick way to discuss, articulate an idea about a concept that people might not be familiar with. And sometimes the easiest thing to do is to use a metaphor. But even that in and of itself, I think sometimes that ease, people really haven't thought about what it is that they're presenting. And I often think that a lot of times racists, they deliberately are using metaphors when they talk about racism, white supremacy, just to get us to not think critically, to not really examine what's being said, to see if it's accurate, to see if it's logical, does it make sense, to just play more on our emotions and to get some sort of emotional response based on what is being said. So if we could not use metaphors, just take a sec or two to really think about what it is that you're saying. No metaphors for the Saturday program. Thank you kindly. With that, the number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-POUND. Ross, I did get your message. I will respond once I get a little bit of time, a little bit of extra time on my hands. I will make sure to get in a response. With that, the first portion of people who dialed in with a hand up, your line is open, and then I'll get to all the other folks who've dialed in as well. First set of folks who dialed in with a hand up, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus, for the program today. Good evening to everyone here today. I am still learning. I have concluded that black people problems are white people. White people lie to black people in all areas of people activity. White people are serious about being serious about practicing racism, white supremacy. Black people have to practice self-respect and self-respect with each other. Black people have to stay focused on a code of thought, speech, and action, and emotional response over and over and over again to replace racism, white supremacy with justice, because our lives are in jeopardy. Gus, I would like to say the prayer this evening. I want to speak on workplace racism. Also, I think that it would be interesting to, I found it interesting to hear the presentation on the suspension of black children in the public school systems. I think it's a microcosm of people activity in the system of racism, white supremacy. It's one of the areas where white people create, maintain, and refine their system of racism, white supremacy. I certainly think it would be also good to discuss the suspension of black children in the schools with Umar Johnson on Monday when you have him on the program. I have no further comments until workplace racism. Thank you, Gus.
Yes, sir. Other folks who have a hand up, feel free.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, greetings, everyone. This is Puff. I wanted to talk about, I feel bad about Prince and really bummed out right now about that. But I'm even more bummed out about that story about the suspension, just like the previous caller. Kids miss out on so much. Like, all those suspension days in one school year, it added up to over a month of school missing. Wow. And, you know, I was just recalling back on my school experience. I have never been in a class with anybody that took vacation. I've never done that. I don't know what is accounting for the big prevalence in, you know, people, you know, ADHD and this diagnosis. I don't know what is accounting for the spike in that kind of diagnosis to where people have their kids on medication, and it just seems like it's a lose-lose situation. Like, it's the kid loses because, you know, he's missing out on the education, and the kid, the other children. Can you imagine being in a classroom with that child who is, you know, missing that much school and doesn't take academics seriously? It's just, it's just mind-boggling to me, man. Just the whole, I just don't understand it. I have never been in a classroom, in my classroom experience, I've never been in a classroom with a child that took medication. And I've been in public school. I went to public school all my whole life. And it's a lose-lose situation, because not only does a child lose, but that child is a distraction. Like, it's so impossible to teach, you know. You just have to keep the kids on track. He's not interested in doing his work and staying on track and focused. And it's horrible. It's just horrible. And the kids that get distracted, and you know, by that kid, but the ones that make good grades and stay focused, they just don't say anything. But the other kids is just like, they be distracted with them, and it's just, they're just so easily drawn into that. It's just, it's terrible. I'll go ahead and mute my line.
Other folks who have a hand up that we have not heard from, do you have commentary? Folks will not lollygag. Make sure that we do not have people who are waiting for the last moment to comment. Nab some of the other folks who have a line open here.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to Puff. And it's great to hear from the brother that's doing the prayer. I always look forward to hearing his commentary, so it's really great to hear him on tonight and all the other callers and listeners. First, I wanted to say thanks for responding. I just wanted to clarify so that it didn't seem like I was denigrating our people. It was more of a mental state than the analogy, like I said in the email, so I appreciate you speaking to that. First, I wanted to say rest in peace to Prince. It's funny because Thomas in New York and I were having a whole discussion about his passing, and just the fact that it was so ironic that shortly after rejecting a deal with Apple as far as them wanting to provide his music on their online site, and him basically rejecting that deal and signing with Tidal Wave, that he ends up passing away. And it kind of reminded me, because of the fact that they said that he had gotten sicker once he got on the plane, it made me think of a very good friend of mine. She's actually a jazz artist. She plays violin, and her husband was a famous jazz drummer who passed away a number of years ago. And he actually had a blood clot in his leg. He didn't know about it. And he went to do a gig, he traveled, he came back, and it was literally right after he got off the plane that he collapsed in the airport and ended up passing away. So I was thinking, I wondered if it was that. And then I saw Scotty Reed post a couple of, I saw him post an article in regards to he's called the Respectability Politics Cannabis, and was the fact that Prince was being prescribed Percocet or oxycodone, which is really Percocet and Tylenol, if that might have contributed to his passing. So I'm really looking forward to finding out what they say was the cause of death, because I feel that he was set up to die after all of his resistance to racism, white supremacy in the area of people activity called entertainment, which I call entercontainment. I wanted to also speak to the children being suspended in schools. It's just interesting because, like Puff, I did not go to school with any kids that were placed on drugs at all. I believe it was the generation after ours, Generation X, that I believe that became really prevalent. And I remember it was my generation, at least in New York City, where they first started to implement metal detectors in school and searching of bags and things like that. So schools were already being set up as a prison prior to the extreme influx of the prison to school pipeline, school to prison pipeline. That was already going on, but I think it intensified with when they started to install the metal detectors and things like that in school. And I found it so, so sad when the mother said that she didn't want her son to be stupid. I just found that so just tragic to hear her think of her son in those terms due to the fact that the system puts this kind of pressure on black children. And I do mirror the sentiments of the first caller when he says that I would love to hear Dr. Umar Johnson's take on that. And I just found it really incredible that in the clip they said that black people made up 17% of the population but made up 70% of the suspensions. Man, if that does not indicate that there's a system of white supremacy and they're starting as early as humanly possible in the destruction of our children, it's just incredible. Just that one statistic just gives a lot of evidence. Also, the clip in regards to Peter Liang just really speaks to the fact that non-white people, especially lighter-skinned non-white people, have been so successfully conditioned to devalue black life no different than white people have devalued black life. And just as actually black people have devalued black lives due to the system of white supremacy. I believe that Akiah Gurley's aunt just accurately addressed the system of racism, white supremacy, and how it functions as a system in the destruction of black life. She spoke about the different killings and with one of the Asian males, the way that he was addressing the situation with Mr. Peter Liang. And I thought that the Asian woman at the end of the clip who spoke to injustice against black people and Asians and black people, non-white people uniting to fight racism, white supremacy, I felt she had a great understanding of the fact that it's all of us that need to fight against the system. But I just think that there's just more that needs to be done so that non-white people really understand that it's a system that as long as you're not white, you're not going to get a chance, and they're going to find a way to use you to further separate all of us so that they can successfully dominate all of us, and most importantly, dominate black people because we are the darkest. The black female who spoke on the Flint, Michigan situation, I thought she used incredibly proper verbiage to describe the system of white supremacy when she talked about the citizens of Flint, the black citizens being children of the mayor and him not taking care of his children, because that's exactly the level that they have put black people on. So they are our parents, and that is the most severe type of mistreatment that you can get when you're not able to access basic necessities like water. And just the fact that it took so long to get any indictments and they did not indict Snyder himself really speaks to the system of white supremacy as well and how it functions to protect white people. And they're willing to sacrifice a couple, but the system will continue to go on. Then lastly, I wanted to speak on the Harriet Tubman being placed on a $20 bill. I just find that it's just incredible. It's one of the greatest refinements of racism, white supremacy, to further this false concept that racism has ended in this country. You know, see, we put Harriet Tubman on a $20 bill, so that means that everything is okay. We have a black president that's now in office that is about to leave soon. So everything is just magically okay, and black people have made all of this headway in the system. And it's just one of the great refinements, because a lot of black people, I think, don't understand that these things are done cosmetically, because white people understand that black people in general tend to function on emotion. I mean, just with all of the riots and things that take place after the killing of black people, we react like children who are hurt rather than like adults who understand the system of white supremacy and understand that it's our collective response to our genocide and our mistreatment that will help to facilitate some sort of change rather than burning down our own neighborhoods. So I think they really work off, they understand that a lot of times they've trained us to work on emotion, and something like this is going to just further that refinement of that confusion that, you know, white people are thinking about us in a way that they weren't thinking about us before, or like Thomas in New York says, white validation. Thank you very much for taking my call, and I'll mute my line there.
Other folks that we have not heard from, if y'all had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I believe I did go to school with kids that were on forms of drugs, and the drugs that they were putting in the school that I was when I was going in, because they tried to put me on it, but my mother stopped them from doing that. Was Ritalin. So that was the drug that I know of. I believe that's still the same drug they try to put kids on today, but I'm not sure what they have today anymore. Kids that were out of control or going, you know, further out of control, we had another school for them. If they didn't get kicked out or suspended from the regular school, they went to another school, and that was like a last chance school. And most of the kids went to that school that they were kicked out of the other schools within the city from where I live. Other than that, the Prince incident, I think that's a form of John Henryism. We did a show or a program on that a little while ago, and I think we should be taking a look at that again for Prince. That's the first thing I thought of as soon as he, you know, when I heard his death. I knew he was having problems with the record label and other companies dealing with his music, trying to get himself what he would call himself out of slavery. And doing that big long fight, you know, when he changes his name to the symbol. We just been on listening to his music today and having, you know, debates with, you know, were memories of our debates, and which of course sparked on again, you know, between me and my wife, you know, was he gay or was he not gay? You know, it's just funny because we're sitting here arguing about Morris Day being gay, but Prince can't be gay. It was, you know, just the craziest things that we think of when someone is gone, and you know, that put the impact on your life because of what they were doing while they were alive. But you know, the only thing is that, you know, you have good memories. I guess that's important, to have really good memories. Let's see. And as far as the flooding, where I'm at, the flooding in Houston, I got friends down there. I ain't seen nothing about the flooding. I ain't seen nothing on my news stations about the flooding, or how bad it is, what kind of rescue efforts, anything, no help. It's just nothing. And I just think that's just it's crazy, man. It's just astounding. It's just, you know, it's just, you're not supposed, I'm not really surprised, I guess. It's just, you know, wow, how come this ain't in my face like it should be? But I guess, you know, just things just keep happening. And I don't know. I'll listen to somebody else talk right now. Mute my line.
Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, feel free. Hope this, again, is not one people. I hope people do not wait till we get ready to transition to workplace racism and then decide they have a bevy of commentary that they would like to share. If we have not heard from you, feel free.
Good evening, everyone. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I just wanted to cover a few things. I know, Gus, I'm not sure. I don't believe you said you gave your prediction for who's going to be elected as the next president of the U.S., but I want to say I definitely believe it's going to be Hillary Clinton. And it just, I saw just, you know, of course, more racism on TV. I guess she did an interview on the popular radio show called The Breakfast Club. And, you know, they were asking her really questions that really, they were kind of not really getting into some real discussion, definitely not about racism, but no direct discussion about racism, which is, you know, to be expected. But, you know, they asked her a question, what do you, you know, what can you not leave the house without having? You know, what do you have to have with you at all times? And her answer was, you know, hot sauce, you know. So it's like, her racism is unbelievable, you know. Just trying to, I guess, supposedly pandering to the, you know, the black audience or whatever. But I think that her her skill level in doing that is going to definitely be a factor in getting her elected as the next president. Also, I've noticed, you know, there's a song out now, which people probably sure have heard of. It's a, you know, a rapper who was, you know, with the Ghetto Boys. His name is Willie D. And the song name is Coon. And again, that word is definitely continuing to be used to refer to black people as. And I just really wish more people would really kind of stick to the code and stop name calling. But, you know, that's the new song that's out, and it's on the internet, and it's being played, you know, quite a bit. Also, just white people with their, instead of them giving black people in particular any type of real compensation, they just give out symbolic compensation, you know, and that's what they're doing with this, with putting Harriet Tubman on, you know, the $20 bill. No real compensation, just something symbolic. I think that white people study us to the point where they know all of our emotional responses. They know exactly what to do, what kind of words to use, what kind of things to do, things to put on TV, any type of media to make us react or feel a certain way. So, you know, again, instead of giving us any type of real compensation, whether it be monetary or, you know, any, definitely not monetary, or some type of land or real estate or some type of commodity like that, they just give us symbolic compensation. But that's all I have for right now. I want to share something for workplace racism. Thank you all. Bye.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Good evening to you and all the callers. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say a couple of things based on what I heard. One, I guess, about Prince with the possible overdose and things like that. Let's just remember that he was kind of, for a man, he was really small. So he might have taken the normal dose and could have affected him differently. Or also, like some people do, if they miss a dose, they think they have to double up or something like that. So when we hear OD and all that, we don't have to, you know, he just did not seem like the type of person who was an overdoser or something like that. So we want to be careful of that. The story about Donny Hathaway and the black person working on the show, I think that's wonderful that we are telling the stories of our own people. That's always wonderful. And the story with the children being suspended, although that is a very sad case, we want to give the mother a lot of, I guess, you know, kudos for black self-respect, because she did also did say in that story that her child was on honor roll, and that even though he was suspended, she made sure she took him to the library, and that's why he was not academically behind. Thank you. That's all.
Caller in the Bay Area, did you have a comment you wanted to get in now, or are you waiting for workplace racism?
Sure. Do I have distortion or background noise?
It's a little bit. It sounds like you might be in a vehicle, but we can hear you.
Yeah, I needed weather stripping. let me pull over real quick so I can say what I got to say. I just personally wanted to comment on the
Oh, everything. Everything was great. But the children in the school, it was so, because I did that with my son. I noticed that they were literally agitating the boys and picking on the boys, the black boys particularly. And then I did notice, I never went to school with anyone that was given those Ritalin drugs, because they were basically, when I was in school, for the soccer moms, the alcoholic drinking white moms, that their children were on Ritalin. But listening to the commentary with the first grader and how they were just actually treating the these children, especially these elementary school children, that looking at that, just in general, because I have an older daughter, watching how the boys were treated differently made me raise my son accordingly, because I knew that they would leave them behind. Because they make sure that the boys are behind, they're delayed, and then they're agitated because the teachers are picking at them. They're making, I'll give you an example. My friend had lived in mountain houses right next to Tracy, and she has a son. He's in an African-centered school now, but that's only because in the Caucasian school that she sent her children to, she thought it was so excellent. And I'm like, no, it's not what you think. No, this is the best school. These are great schools. When she went to go sit in her son's class, because they're saying how much of a disturbance this child is, there was a seat, there was an area created in the classroom, and his mother said, oh, what's that? Oh, this is Khalib's corner. So every time he's bad, we put him over here, and any other child that's bad, we just put him over there too, so it's called Khalib's corner. So that's when she realized that they're singling her son out. I wanted to also comment on Harriet Tubman on the money, and I just thought it was kind of weird how everything coincided in, like, within 3 days. You had that verdict that was on the hush. As far as it wasn't on the television, with the Asian officer, and then you had, because we're always distracted with something or another, the election stuff that's going on, and then all these basketball games that we love so much. And then the next thing you know, out of the blue, Prince just dies. And I always look at the flip side of the coin, because I know how, all my life I recall Prince, and I know how he was about his art and his music. And I remember, like the other callers were stating, how he had that fight with the record labels, and he changes all the stuff that he had to go through, and then all of a sudden he passed. So I just thought, it just seems like they do these little things to distract us from what's really going on, and it kind of sucks, because now we're so focused on what song is your favorite Prince song, and what versus what really happened. Why are they telling us everybody's on juice drugs? So that's kind of all I wanted to state. And I do want to participate in workplace racism, because I am so having an issue. So I'd like to share that when time permits, and I'll mute my line. And thank you so much.
For sure. Thomas in New York. I thought I had him in. No, there we go. Thomas in New York. Did you have commentary you wanted to share, sir? I thought I'd opened your line, but I guess I didn't.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all.
Your volume is a little low. Can you speak up, please, sir?
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all. Another day on the plantation. I had a few comments to make about the clips and observations as well. You know, just when I thought these white people couldn't possibly top their last act of racism, they do something else that tops their last act of racism. It's come down to them putting slaves on money. You know, if you ever wanted to own a slave, now you'll be able to. Smiling, semi-smiling, happy-looking Harriet Tubman on a $20 bill. Now, all the pictures I ever saw of Harriet Tubman, she looks downtrodden, hardened, not happy, like she's pissed off about her situation. You know, she's freeing slaves under constant threat of death or re-enslavement, constantly on the run. And they got a picture of her looking kind of healthy and kind of with a smirk, you know. And I could see now, just from, you know, these white Jewish owners of the entertainment industry, will have a rapper, you know, shooting a video in a strip club, throwing a bunch of Tubmans at a young black lady. You know, I could just see it going on, and I could just see how everyone around the world will perceive that image. You know, I prefer to have regular old white slave masters on my money, not the slaves. And, you know, trying to explain racism, you know, in the era that this money comes out, and they talk about 2030, I think, you know, try to explain racism to the kids who grown up with a black person on a bill for, you know, this money don't, you know, racism don't exist. Look at my $20 bill, you know. That clip you played about Prince, I was happy Stevie Wonder didn't sing a Prince song. I find that white people like to do that, put us on the spot, sing us a song. You know, it reminds me of Nas when he said, you know, he's on the yacht, the Tommy Hilfiger invited him on, and he's parlaying with all the rich white folks, and Tommy Hilfiger jumps out. Hey, Nas, kick a rap, you know. He was like, whoa, you know. But, you know, they're doing their jobs. You know, if you think about the 80s, you know, Luther Vandross is gone. Michael Jackson is gone. Michael Jackson was a quarter of his estate just sold for about $1.5 billion, but he died broke, they said. Whitney Houston gone, and now Prince. And all of them are gone, and Madonna's still alive. It's, you know, the system is just working perfectly. Prince had some financial issues a few years ago. It wasn't so much financial issues. He didn't want Warner Brothers to control his name and image for the rest of his life, and he fought them and started putting Slave on, because that's what he was. And so he didn't have to pay Warner Brothers. He changed his name to a symbol, copyright the symbol. Therefore, they couldn't make any money off of it. He published his own work and fought for them. And it's ironic, just like I mentioned last week about that earthquake, 2 years to the day almost, April 18th, 2014, he won the case, and he made it. He's pretty much like the Kurt Flood of the music industry, because now all the artists can, after 35 years, reclaim their own original works. That wasn't possible before. The record industry can't hold on to their works, and therefore he was able to decide who and where he wanted his music played on, and he sued people for playing his music without his permission. And he did well, and like Raj just mentioned, sued Apple, won, but now that his music's all over Apple, very ironic. You know, Cop Liang, man, you know, I would love to see black people go and protest all the Chinese restaurants, you know,
don't eat Chinese food for a while,
because, you know, the Chinese community, I didn't expect a lot from them. But all I hear is white cops get away with shooting y'all niggas, and we should be allowed to get away with shooting y'all niggas too. And that guy who, the comptroller from New York, I mean, a lot of black people went and voted for him. Even when he tried to become the mayor, they supported him. And the first chance he gets, you know, he's not, I mean, if this was his kid, forget about the fact that he shot the dude. He didn't call for help. The girlfriend's doing CPR. You're a cop. You're trained in these things. I mean, at least you should be. It's just utterly ridiculous that they didn't give him 2 years, you know, a year and a day. You know, I mean, I know people who, black people who get caught with a gun in New York, man, it's three to eight years mandatory, you know, unless you're a rapper, you get a year or maybe two. But, I mean, it's just a mandatory thing. And he uses a gun in a crime and does, and then tries to cover it up in nothing. And I'm very disappointed in the black DA in Brooklyn County, Kings County, Brooklyn, for dropping the ball. I hate to use the metaphor. I'm sorry, Gus. For totally screwing up and letting this man go free. It's just terrible. And I do get what the lady said. I do respect the fact that he did take him to court. He got a conviction. That's much, way better than what they did in Staten Island. I mean, if it happened in the county I'm in, New York County, Manhattan, it wouldn't, I doubt they'll get a conviction here either. He did go the extra mile, but just to free him, it was just dead wrong. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks who dialed in that we have not heard from, feel free. I think.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. I thought I heard a female caller. Were you with us?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. This is Princess, and it's been a while since I've called in. I've been kind of busy, but I heard most of the news clips, and all I could pretty much say is being on the losing team can be very depressing. But I think I had called in about a month ago or so about this case that I have, an incident that had occurred at a Walmart here in New Orleans. And a few weeks ago, while I was at work, the detectives involved had showed up at my dad's place and basically was saying that my initial recorded statement somehow magically was deleted. And so a couple of weeks ago when the detectives called me, I had pretty much, he told me what was going on, and I just listened. And then I immediately asked, I said, well, does this always happen? And he got excited. I was like, oh, no, this has never happened before. This is the first time, and this, that, and other. And I didn't give him an immediate response. I just paused to, and then I said, so you're telling me that you guys, the recording was deleted or it didn't upload to their system or whatever it was. And he was like, no, it didn't. So we just need to take a quick statement and this, that, and the other. And what I'm thinking is because according to them, they were trying to initially, I had already sent that they were trying to initially give the perpetrators a lighter sentencing, where it would be charged as a theft versus a robbery, because according to them, they're trying to dispute whether or not I had my handbag in possession or was it in the cart, which is, like I told them, that shouldn't matter. I went after the guy and demanded my purse back, and it was all on recording. People saw it and this, that, and the other. And he was actually trying to, argue with me that my purse wasn't my purse. And, but it's like it's becoming harder for me. Not that I would have believed it anyways, but you can't convince me that white people have any intention of doing anything right by a black person, because like I said, for something even just as easy as this, no, I don't see it. They work in tangent to try and help and cover one another, even when they're committing like a petty crime or something like this. It's just crazy. So I hadn't called the detective back, because I was just trying to get some information, perhaps from some people, if there's anybody on the line who may be able to give me some advice, because like I said, I've been working a lot, so I hadn't been able to contact a couple of people that I had spoken to about it. But if anybody has any ideas, I greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Did the guy hit you? Did the person who stole your pocketbook, did he touch you or snatch it off of you in any way like that? Or did he just snatch your pocketbook and run?
No, it was both a white female and a white male, and they were working in a team. And
Did they touch you?
No.
Oh, then that's not going to be a robbery unless they touch you. Like, if I could go to the store and steal some gum and walk out and they come and arrest me, that's a burglary. If I take the gum and touch one of the employees there and run out the store, that's an armed robbery. So that's why they're not charging them with robbery. If they were black, of course, they would charge them with robbery. but obviously they're not going to go the extra mile with these white people.
Well, I heard one of the codes that they were using, they were saying initially that he was going to be charged with a felony, and it was a 67, but then when the police officer, as I finished doing my recorded statement, had pulled up and he had told the guy what they were being charged with, the other police officer was, like, looking puzzled, and he was like, well, I'll explain to you. He initially said, he was like, you're not going to charge him with a 65. And he was like, no, it's a 67. I'll explain to you what had happened, though. And then that's when he had pulled off, and, you know, we continued talking a little bit and stuff. I don't know what a 67 is versus a 65 as far as the charge. I'm not familiar with stuff here in Louisiana. All I know is Louisiana is very corrupt.
The system of white supremacy, massive operation of corruption worldwide. If folks have commentary or, I guess, suggestions or what have you that they would like to share, I know one thing that came to mind with me. I'm not surprised about them losing the recording. I've heard that before, whether it's a statement, if someone came in and gave a sworn affidavit or what have you, if it was a black person, somehow it got lost, they can't find it, it got destroyed, just something inexplicably that ends up being harmful to a non-white person. It might be something where you can ask if you're supposed to be giving a recorded statement, if they're recording, if you can record as well. I know a lot of people with the technology that exists now, people have cell phones and what have you, and to ask if you can, you know, do your own recording, or even if you don't ask them and just have it in your pocket or what have you, and just do it that way that you have a copy in case something like that happens. That might be, I want to check in with some of the people that haven't been able to speak at all, and then if folks have suggestions, we'll make time for that also before we get to workplace racism. Caller in Ohio, did you have commentary you wanted to share? Good to hear from you, Princess.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Good evening to you, Gus, the host, and to all the callers and listeners on the line. Just a couple of things that I want to say. As far as Prince, and just to let you know, he's been cremated. Something I was reading on Facebook, Reuters is reporting that he's been cremated, so I guess later on they'll have a service. But it's something about, you know, it's like you said, all these entertainers, like when it comes to us, like drugs. And I read what the gentleman mentioned, what Scotty Reed had written. But my thing is, so it was like, well, he was going into Walgreens, and then you get to talk about Percocet drugs. And I'm like, that's what the media is saying. That's what the media is saying. You say somebody's going to Walgreens. What else is, well, Walgreens does not only sell drugs. They sell everything else. You know, and so I'm just, you know, I guess I'm just, you know, all this speculation and how we can put things out, you know what I'm saying? And then people hear that and just run with that. And when I see, you know, hear that with Prince, you know, because that's the thing. Oh, it's got to be drugs. It's got to be drugs. And I was telling my sister earlier, I said, you know, I said, sometimes we act, I said, not that it's usual, and it may not be that unusual, but anybody can drop dead at any time. I mean, that's just life, you know. For whatever reason, the heart stops, that's it. And, you know, not trying to offer, like, no excuses. I mean, I don't know anything about Prince. I told my sister, I said, of all that I follow Prince, I said, I've never, ever heard anything of drugs, you know. So, you know, but I'm just saying that how the media says stuff and we jump on it so fast. And I can remember listening to a piece of Dr. Amos Wilson, a YouTube video, and one thing he said one thing about black people, he said, you are so easy to believe what other people say about you. So I just wanted to say that right there. And, you know, it is really, you know, heartbreaking that, you know, that he did pass. About the school children and drugs, I can remember, oh, man, this had to be like in the early 90s before I moved to Alabama, and I was back here in Ohio and working with the young lady. And, you know, she had a child that was taking Ritalin. And I had vaguely heard about it. It was like it was coming in, this thing was happening. And she was talking about how she was getting that drug, and she was selling it. And so when I became a substitute teacher in Georgia, I was living in Georgia, and this was in 2000, living in Georgia, and I could see a lot of it. I remember one time I went to a class, and all the students in that class would be, I guess, what they would call special needs. And you had a lot of, you know, black, it wasn't a lot of kids in the class, because those classes are, you know, classrooms do not have a lot of kids. But you had black, you had white, you had Latinos, you know. But there were, I know it was one student in there that he was on drugs, and he literally was like a zombie. Cutest little thing at the time, you know, young boy. Cutest little thing, but he was just like a zombie. He would just sit there. And this other teacher that worked in the class, she told me, she said one day he had come to school, his parents and his mother had given him his medicine. And she said that little boy checked that class out that day, you know. And it was just so sad, though. And so, you know, you can see it, and a lot of it has, and there's money with it. I have a great niece, and I was talking to her, Easter, and they come down, and we were talking about it, and she was saying how a teacher was talking to her. It wasn't her children. She has two children at school. They do, two daughters. They do pretty good. But she said how that somebody had even said something to her about, you can make money off of it. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, you can get the Ritalin, or you can get whatever drug it is, and you can sell it and make money for yourself. So it's all a game. It's all a scam. And it's unfortunate, though, because our children are being hurt by this. And I think in the archives of one of your programs, one time you had Dr. Umar Johnson on there, and he was even talking about how you have teachers who are not trained in these psychological things, but who are making diagnoses. Oh, this child needs to be on some kind of medication. This child needs to be on some kind of medication. And I remember he said they don't have training to even be able to say that. And basically what you have is in some of these classrooms, because children will be children. I do think, you know, as generations go, you know, children could be a lot more forceful, and that word, put that word in quotes, today, you know, even in their young age. But you have basically schools who literally do not want children to be children, because these kids are being kicked out of school or medicated for child behavior. You know, children just can't sit still. Children will be children, you know. And I think that's a whole big game in and of itself. And just like with special education, there's a lot of money in this thing called special education. You know, there's a lot of money. There's a lot of money in that with the drugs and the children. And let me see. Oh, I think the Donny Hathaway thing was good. I like the idea, because we need, you know, there's got to be more and more talk about mental health, and especially mental health in black people. I can always remember that quote that Dr. Welsing used to say, you know, when she was going to medical school, and how, you know, she said they were told black people just don't have it, so they don't get mental health. You just give them drugs. And I remember she said today that pretty much still stands. You just want to give drugs to blacks that exhibit what we would call mental health, instead of for talking to them, trying to find out what's going on. Like the mother of the student said, my child feeling like he's not wanted, and that does affect our children. And so I thought that was a really good piece, like something that could be explored, because I read a little bit about Donny Hathaway, and I can remember hearing the, as he was talking about the voices in his head, and, you know, I just think it's like, oh my God, to, you know, to live like that, and that there's something in your head that you just can't shut off, and unfortunately, you feel the only way you can shut this voice off in your head is to take their life, you know. And let me see if there was anything else. I guess that's it. Thank you. I'll be myself. Thank you, though. Mm-hmm.
Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, we are getting close to workplace racism, so feel free if we have not heard from you.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to make it really quick. The thing about Harriet Tubman, you know, putting her on, I believe, the $20 bill, that reminds me of what Dr. Welsing said, how white folks, you know, practice racism when, like, they'll name a street after Dr. King, King Boulevard, or name a building after, you know,
Booker T. Washington, because under white supremacy, white people will say the only good nigger is a dead nigger. And that's all I have.
Other folks that we have not heard from, if you dialed in, we haven't heard from you yet.
Can you hear?
I heard two people. We'll get firefighter in New York. Excuse me, Florida, sorry.
Greetings. Yes, I just arrived back. Is it all right?
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay, I just arrived back from a lecture from Mr. Tariq Rashid. And it was pretty constructive. I like his approach, and it kind of like attracts in a constructive way a lot of younger non-white black people. And he basically fits his lectures in the same light and as like Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller. And I just like the whole idea when I hear a non-white black person who is talking in front of us, and they use the words racism, white supremacy, instead of words like European, you know, and other words like that. That's kind of like not precise as it can possibly be. And so it was, in my opinion, very fruitful, very, very constructive. Yes, I also got into conversations about the system of racism and white supremacy putting our ancestor, Harriet Tubman, on one of their instruments of terrorism. And it's really shows the lack of interest in our well-being that white people have of us, they have a knowledge though that we are, unfortunately, still a lot of us are still emotional and can easily be pacified on thinking that there's such thing as improvement when it comes to the system of race of white supremacy. And in reality, either it exists or it doesn't exist, period. Other than that, I guess right now I'll just wait. I have a real excellent story on workplace racism. Although I'm known as a retired firefighter, I am in a workplace environment. Happened to be in the public school system that I've been in for over 30 years on the high school level. That I'll wait and state what I have to say about that. Thank you.
For sure, the person in 9039, did you have comments you wanted to get in?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, and thank you to all the callers and listeners. I just want to get in real quick with each one of the stories about Prince's death, the gentleman who was speaking about the Peter Liang, speaking on the behalf of the Chinese Americans or the Asian Americans that are behind him, the child and the mother, how he was how he was being put in school, but at the same time being sectioned off and suspended and things like that. I view all of those things in the system of racism and white supremacy as as a perpetuation of the deception. Deception is, to me, is a basic part of racism and white supremacy. And as long as you're able to be deceived, you can't see. Like I never say, it's weird to me that this happened, or it's odd. It's, in my view, it's not. In my view, under this system of racism, white supremacy, this is the norm. This is how it's supposed to be. So it's not odd. It's odd that we're in it, you know. But the things that are happening, they're not out of place. They're happening just as they're supposed to. So when I hear these things and I see these things, I sit back and my mind automatically goes to how it can stop from happening. You know, how I'm just thinking about, gentlemen speaking about Peter Liang, and it's like he wanted to bring every other issue into the conversation except for being held accountable. And like I said, unconscious, you hear that and you're like, why are you talking about this? Why are you going into this about this? Chinese Americans and all these other things. Consciously, you say to yourself, there it is right there, racism, white supremacy. Trying to deceive the focus of paying for what you did. And I have comments on workplace racism, but I thank you for hearing me, and I'll meet my line.
For sure. We are pretty much at time to transition to workplace racism. If we missed anybody, we can do like 90 seconds. If there's somebody who had a hand up who has not been able to share at all before we get to workplace racism, or if anyone had a suggestion that they wanted to offer Princess, we have 90 seconds.
I had a quick question for Princess. I wanted to know if after the incident, if you either recorded it yourself or if you wrote it down somewhere before you went into to file the recording with the police?
No, actually, it just so happened I was in use of my phone and I had several people. I was doing a hangout for a show, and we had just finished up. And so my phone was on low, but I kept people on just for my safety. And, like I said, I wasn't able to record because my phone was just about to die. And so, but I do have my documentation that I wrote down, but I had already said if I were to go ahead and do the additional recording, it will definitely be recorded, because I had even asked them, would I be able to get a copy? And he said, oh, no, once it records, it gets uploaded to their system and sent to the secretary or whoever, does the documentation, and then over to somewhere else. And after we finished the recording, we listened to a good portion of it just to make sure everything had been recorded properly, and he showed me that it was saved and this, that, and other. So I told him I just found it, my word was strange, and he was kind of a bit taken back because I was just being very cynical about their intentions at that point. So and it was just kind of strange because they showed up here late in the evening. It was after midnight, I believe. They showed up here at my dad's house, and I was still at work, and they were trying to get me to do the statement then and stuff. And I was just like, it was just all weird. My dad still has a case out against NOPD because of what happened last February to him, and no one has yet followed up with him about it. So he's already on guard whenever police come to our house or anything.
I was thinking that could possibly be a part of the issue, because they know both of you have cases against them, and I just wanted to put out there, I know sometimes when we go through these situations in racism, white supremacy, it can be highly stressful, and sometimes it's hard to think clearly. I would say we should get in the habit of immediately recording any incidents of these types so that if something like that happens where they claim they lost the recording or something, you can, even if you do it verbally on your phone, even if you transcribe something, just bring a written statement that has all that detail so that in case something like that happens, you have something you can refer to that literally you wrote moments after the incident, so you don't have to worry about trying to remember something in case. We should just get in that habit of immediately recording every detail possible just so that we have something that's immediately accessible in case white supremacists pull something like that, because it's a lot harder to remember those things after time has passed and all of those kinds of things. So, and also now that you talked about the incident with your father too, they might be making a concerted effort to try and thwart one out of the two of you because they know both of you have a situation pending against them. Thanks for listening to me.
For sure. We will transition to workplace racism. Folks have comments they would like to add. The number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. We had two people that wrote in commentary on workplace racism. Let's see, the one person that wrote in said, I recently started a job as an electrical controls technician. My job was to build and wire custom panels. I initially thought this job would be a good fit because it was a small company, meaning there would be less whites to deal with. Also, my work area was secluded from everyone else in the shop, which was good. A few red flags were raised when I first started. First red flag was that I was the only black person on the job. Second red flag was raised when I started my first project. I noticed that the blueprints had important information missing or incorrect details, making it difficult to complete the work. I worked through these problems and began to make progress. Third red flag raised was the lack of communication on specific ways, things they wanted done, aesthetics, measurements, etc. This past Thursday, I was reading Yorugu on my 9 a.m. break as I usually do. I usually stay at my shop desk and read to avoid talking to other white males on the job. Well, the owner came in my area on my break and noticed me reading Yorugu. I believe he went into the office and Googled the title of the book. By 10 a.m., I was terminated. The owner didn't give any specific reason for my termination. I'm convinced it had everything to do with me reading Yorugu. I was never late. I didn't have any write-ups. Never got any verbal warnings. Next time, I'll try to be more codified on the plantation. Just my quick thought on this is that it's kind of in the same logic about what I've said consistently, and I think others, about not talking about racism on the job. Even if whites bring it up, I still would not be talking and sharing my views. If they want to talk about it, I would just listen. I would also, because I know other people have said in trying to be more constructive with how they use their time and energy in reading, that they'll bring different books on the job. I definitely would not encourage reading anything that, like a Yorugu or the ISIS papers, Mr. Fuller's book, whatever the case may be, where it's something that it's talking honestly, accurately about racism, what it means to be white. It's been my opinion, I say this consistently, white people are not ignorant about racism, and you should just think of all of them. They are highly alert to studying their niggers and seeing what you're reading, what you're talking about, particularly if you look like you might be any sort of deviation from the typical confused victim. They pay a lot of attention to that. I even had a non-white person. They got copies of Mr. Fuller's code book, and they got them mailed to their job. When they went to the desk or wherever the mail, you know, comes in at to get the package, it had already been opened. And the little race soldiers on the job had the audacity to say, oh, man, we're so sorry. We opened it. A rat got into the package. And it was, you know, open when we got here. So we just went ahead and opened the whole book. That is what you can expect from racists. So I really would not encourage reading like that in plain view on the job. If you want to read, take a break on the job. I'd say maybe see if you can go in your vehicle where you have some more privacy. Certainly, I would not encourage leaving any book like that out in the open, and maybe even have a book jacket on the book. That way they can't see the cover. But just keep that in mind. That's who we're dealing with, racist man, racist woman. The other person that wrote in with the workplace situation, they said... Sure, I can pull this. Okay.
The other person wrote in and said, I messaged you because I was hearing a little bit of background noise. See if I can clear my line out. Okay. I messaged you a while back because I was dealing with some other disruptive nonsense while working in IT. After spending approximately $40,000 on a degree, I gave up because I couldn't take having to deal with them racist daily. After my IT career, I picked up a CDL for a while. I was happier than ever, but having a family, I couldn't just live out on the road, so I have become a freight broker for a foreign-born person who happens to be genetically predisposed to despising black people. Now I have to deal with having jokes and gossip happening in front of my face. I know they're doing it, and they know I know, but it still happens. Frustrated with this system, I have acquired more accounts than my counterpart who starts at the same time as I, yet I feel I'm one step from being fired always. How would you deal with this? Any advice? Another victim of their antagonistic onslaught. I told this person, I said, I think pretty much every victim of racism, white supremacy, even President Obama, anybody else you can think of, pretty much has that same sort of feeling that they are about one remark from being fired, that today could be their last day in any respective job that they have, any field that they happen to be in. That's just the system of racism, white supremacy. It's a lot of different ways that you could go with them making these sort of tacky comments, racist jokes and what have you, and just verbalizing their contempt for black people. You can write it down. I know Mr. Fuller has given that out frequently as a suggestion to make a note of exactly what's saying, recorded, date, time, all of that, so that you are building your own evidence, your own documentation of a pattern of racist hostility and unprofessional behavior on the job, so that you can bring that up at a later date if you so choose. You can ask, you know, is this professional behavior? Is this the way we're supposed to conduct ourselves on the job? Everybody just making disparaging remarks about people. You know your work environment better than I do. Some work environments are just, you know, that's just what it is. There are no rules and regulations. People can just talk crass and rude and curse and be profane all day long, and there's not going to be a write-up. You know, that's just the environment that is encouraged. So you know your work environment, but there are a lot of different ways that you can handle that sort of situation. You can say nothing. You can choose to say something about it. But I mean, under the system of racism, white supremacy, I did hear Mr. Fuller say that sort of thing is pretty standard. As you've already stated, it seems like similar things were happening on the job that you left before. And Mr. Fuller has talked before about you don't really want to get in a pattern of leaving a job because it's racist, because the whole world is racism, white supremacy. You're just going to be going to look for another source of employment and most likely dealing with the same type of tacky behavior. But I said I would share it on the program and see if folks had any thoughts they wanted to share. Folks had suggestions, comments on the first two incidents that I read, feel free. If not, if you have your own incidents of racism, white supremacy you would like to share, feel free. If there's anybody that we haven't heard from at all who is just waiting for workplace racism, you should probably go first.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, listeners, and callers. There was a few observations from this week. I just want to point out some of the very bold behavior patterns of white females. I had one just come up to me just saying, "Oh, well, hey, cutie pie, how's it going?" And things like that, you know, being very bold. Like a lot of the older ones upstairs, and you know, this person has a Confederate flag on the front of her vehicle. And there was this one, it was her and a younger white female. You know, I walk in to collect some papers, you know, and I definitely try to stick to that advice, the way you say, you know, make sure you're not staying alone with a white woman. So I was just trying to hurry up and get on out of there, you know, and she just said, "Oh man," said, he is so cute. He this and that, debonair. She kept saying that word, debonair. And, you know, when are you going to dance on the table for us? And I just said, hey, I'm not doing that. So, you know, I just left. And I noticed this white supervisor, she will, like, she'll point at me, you know, like with her index finger. And one time she circled her finger around and pointed in it. And that's kind of like some symbolically making a bullseye or a target symbol. Like, you know, like I was thinking about that, like, why is she circling her hand around, her finger around? But, you know, that could have been it, or it may have been something else. And there was another comment that was made in my presence, but it wasn't directed toward me. She was talking to the white male supervisor, this white woman. And for some reason, I came up in a conversation, and she said something about, you know, how young I was or something, and the guy said, oh, what are you trying to say about him, you know, about what he looks like? And she's like, oh, no, I see Blink is one of my sons. That's what she said. And he said, are you calling him a child? And he was laughing when he said it, you know, like, you know, very, very brutal, you know, racist statement, I suspect. And she just started, you know, getting choked up in her words and her responses, you know, so I didn't really respond to anything because, you know, no statements or no questions made directed to me. You know, it was two white people talking. And there was a, I was talking to a black female that she was in a meeting because there was a whole bunch of conflict and strife in their department. And there was a new black female in that area, and she was facing a whole bunch of problems with, you know, a lot of the white women trying to get her kicked out, I guess. And she was just getting very, you know, emotional and getting very angry and upset. And I guess they were trying to manipulate that about her character. And I guess she was just saying that she was getting fed up. And they finally ended up having a meeting where this white male supervisor, he ends up getting very angry and hostile at two of the black females. So in one of the meetings, he just said, don't you dare point at me. You know, like he got what I would call unrefined, you know, very angry. And at least from what she was telling me. And she told me that he said he mentioned something to her, but she said, thank you, God, in the meeting. And he said something about, you know, forget about your God. This is my meeting right now. You know, so I don't know what that's supposed to have meant. But she was very shocked and appalled by that. So, yeah, that's pretty much my report for this week.
Fascinating that white women are extremely dangerous in the workplace situation, white people in general, but I would say white women. Wow. That latter incident, that's one of those. And I think we had one of our female callers, she talked about before, about when racists, when they're just being verbally abusive and making, you know, calling you nigger or whatever they're doing verbally, that sometimes it can be challenging, you know, to be that disciplined where you don't get emotional about it. You don't let it affect you to where you're really hurt or surprised and that sort of thing. And it's so important to get that level of discipline and not being surprised that, hey, I know what I'm dealing with. I understand what it means to be white, even if they, you know, come in and they're not doing that sort of thing for the first 2 years, 3 years, 10 years that I'm here. Bam, it could happen at any time just because this is the system of racism, white supremacy. They are white, dedicated to racism. White person says that sort of thing on the job, man, in my view, we would be making spectacular progress. They say something like that. Hey, we don't want to hear about your guy. I'm running this meeting here. I just pull out my pen and write that. Forget my God. This is your meeting. Not that you'd have to say it out loud, but just write that down. Date, time. This is what you said. And keep right on rolling. Next item on the meeting. I'm not upset. I'm not surprised. You haven't hurt my feelings because I'm not expecting you to treat me with any sort of quote-unquote dignity, regard, respect. I'm not even expecting you to be courteous to me because I understand that's not who you are. I understand who I'm dealing with, males, females, all of you. I don't expect anything other than tacky,
racist, abusive behavior. That way I will never be stunned and I'll never have my feelings hurt. In my view, I think that can also go a long way to decreasing, minimizing some of the stress that we take on as a result of all this. But that's just my thought. Folks, had anybody had any suggestions or observations about what they just heard? Feel free. If not, then if other folks have commentary they would like to share, workplace racism, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to lay down some foundation to what you just said and to workplace racism. I agree with what you just said. Black people are in a very hostile environment in the workplace, specifically the black male. Racism, white supremacy is prevailing in the workplace. When black people get on these jobs, we have got to realize that these places are not built for us. Black people on the job are unwelcomed people. Black people can be fired from the job by white people at any time with or without legitimate business reason. Black people should go on the job expecting to be fired by white people at any time. I am on the job and in my position for the illusion of inclusion. I understand that white people can fire me at any time. White people are only tolerating black people in the workplace. White people can discriminate, harass, demean, devalue, and marginalize black people in the workplace without consequences. Black people experience racial battle fatigue in the workplace every day. Working with white people is a battlefield. Now, I want to share with you one of my workplace experiences, but it was not specifically subjected to me. In my job, I hear employees who file grievances in the workplace, and a black female filed a grievance because she was suspended for weak work performance and inappropriate conduct. So I had to contact the employee and her manager to set up a meeting to discuss what the employee's grievance description and details were and what she wanted as a remedy. So when I gathered the employee and her manager, who was a black female, who was not the black female's immediate supervisor, the black female's immediate supervisor was a white woman. When I gathered the employee and her black female manager, who was at the third level because I was hearing the grievance at the third level, I asked the grievant what was the concerns that she had, and she said that she was subjected to discrimination, harassment, inappropriate conduct by the white woman, and stress in the workplace, that black people in the workplace are treated differently. They are punished severely, and white people doing the same infractions get away with it. So after she had informed me that she had been discriminated and that she was stressed in the workplace, we heard her concerns, the manager and I, and told her that we would get back to her in 10 days with a decision based on the presentation that she gave about her concerns. So after the meeting, I sit down and talk to the white manager and ask her what she thought. The black manager told me that she believes that there is some merit to the black grievance concerns. What do I do? So I informed the black manager that what I recommend that she do is request an environmental survey in that specific program, because an environmental survey would canvass everybody in that department with an anonymous letter asking them what is the environment and how they believe they are treated in the workplace. The environmental survey is also sent to employees who currently work in the department and former employees in the department. What I wanted to say to the manager is, unfortunately, with the environmental survey, but I could not say this to her because I know how the system of racism, white supremacy works. I only gave the manager the information on what I recommended that she do because she believed that there was some merit to the black lady's claim in her grievance. And I recommended that she do the environmental survey. But with the environmental survey, once the survey is done, it once again, those surveys go to white people who ultimately make the decision. And I wanted to tell her, but I could not say this. Do you really believe that white people are going to find any merit to this black woman's claim of discrimination and harassment in the workplace? She's preaching discrimination and harassment to other white people, and they are not going to find any merit to her claim. And unfortunately, these are the kind of things that we have to deal with in the workplace. So when I got back after the meeting, when I got back to my work site, my manager asked me what happened at the meeting and how did it go. So I told my manager that the woman claimed discrimination and harassment in the workplace and that she was stressed in the workplace. So I told my manager because she informed me that she was discriminated against and her feeling stressed in the workplace, I have to file a complaint to an agency that investigates claims of discrimination, and I have to notify our return to work unit when an employee claims that she's stressed in the workplace so that she can get information about family medical leave in the event that she has to leave her job because she's stressed in the workplace. It will protect her employment rights. My manager said, oh, just go ahead. She's filed two complaints already, and the agency didn't find any merit, so I don't think there's going to be any merit to this one that you're going to file on her behalf. And I thought to myself, he's exactly right because he's part of the system as well. And it's unfortunate, like I said, that we as black people experience racial battle fatigue in the workplace every day. And working with white people is a battlefield that we don't stand a chance to win.
Was that?
That's it.
Oh, okay, okay. I've never heard of that, the environmental survey. That is interesting. Although the conclusion of it all that eventually after everyone has filed all this paperwork and we've chopped down a whole forest of trees to give out the files and everything on this, that when the most powerful people, whites, make the decision, no merit, seems like the niggers made up some stuff here. I have heard that often every time when that sort of thing happens. Folks have suggestions or comments or any ideas about things that maybe a recommendation in terms of what could have been done in that situation?
And you know, the thing about it, Gus, in my job, in my position, I see this every day, and unfortunately, I can't say anything to the white managers about how the system works. I mean, to the black managers about how the system works, because they believe that it's a that the employee who's making these claims or is going to get some kind of justice, and that is the furthest thing from the truth. Because how are you going to get any justice with filing a claim against white people and having to send your claim to other white people to make a decision? It just does not compute.
That is the problem. If other folks have comment or observations, certainly about what we just heard, that is something very important to keep in mind. I think that's why frequently I've heard folks, when they give out suggestions, it will be to not make a report with an accusation of racism, because that's about what's going to happen. In fact, that was even in the school suspension report when the children were making allegations of that they were being abused and mistreated. The principal had grabbed the one child by his, I guess, the hood on his hoodie or sweatshirt or what have you, and said, oh, we don't have any evidence. No merit. Moving forward. Next case. That's pretty much what you can expect in the system of racism, white supremacy. if folks and why it is encouraged to make a report of something other than racism, because that's pretty much what whites are going to do. Not founded, no racists here. We all love one another. We all got black boyfriends and black girlfriends. And, you know, we all been listening to Prince for the last 2-3 days. So no racists here. Any observations, or if folks have their own incidents that they would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
We'll get our female caller, and then we'll get retired firefighter.
Yes, sir.
He can go first.
I think she yielded the floor, retired firefighter.
Oh, yes, sir. I didn't hear most of the caller's report, mainly because, well, combination, I guess my volume is not doesn't go high enough, and his voice was kind of soft, and I didn't hear a lot of it. But the last part he did say made a lot of sense to me when he was stating that I would assume this is a non-white person who wrote an accusation to some sort of on-the-job organization, and they're also a white, and therefore, you know, and he's talking in line of logic. I'm talking about the caller and stating that, you know, well, the person that you're writing to is basically related under the system of racial white supremacy to the person that you had the racist issue with. So it would motivate us to find a more logical means to be able to work against the system of racial and white supremacy. But anyway, my workplace racism experience is weak. Number one, I need to state that I was not the subject, but I was in very close proximity to witness something that can be identified as a high level of self-respect based on the victim that I'm about to, the victim of racial white supremacy I'm about to report on. And it was also constructive enough to be a case study in a constructive way to a lot of young people. I'm talking about, as some of you know, that I've also been a football coach since 1981. I'm presently at a high school that's down in the southern part of Miami-Dade County, and we were in the gym. The reason why is because they're doing renovations at the school at the time, and so there's some rooms you can go in, there's some rooms you cannot go into. So after the end of school day, we had a meeting, because we're about to start spring football practice. And so we had a meeting with the young people in the gym. So we're talking about approximately right now 50 to 65 males. At least 99% of them are black males. So we're in there, and also just so happens the band, for the same reasons, are in the gym too after school. And we wasn't really doing anything as a football team other than that they're up in the stands. So the musical director is a black female. She was once a member of the famous Floyd and Marching 100. This was before the beating death of the drum major when she was there. And but nevertheless, she's the band director at the high school. And she's very melanated. She has her hair. I'm just talking about the externalness. She has her hair plaited of all of her natural hair. And this is the presentation of this person on the outside. And we've had real good conversations between her and myself, and also the head football coach. And it's a very, very constructive relationship. Anyway, as we were she was doing, you know, what she does with the band, and what we were just waiting to go somewhere else. I'm talking about as a coaching staff and the football team. So in comes the athletic director, white male. And I noticed he had this duty look about him as he passed. But I, you know, kind of like took my attention off of it. And the next thing I know, she started communicating with him and saying, you're not going to disrespect me in here. You're going to be professional to me. You're not going to talk down to me. And I'm gonna tell you on how prevalent her voice was. I'm not saying it was like shouting loud, but it, the words that came out of her mouth were so razor sharp and precise, it grew the attention of these teenagers up in the stands, to whereas they started clapping. They literally started clapping on her behalf. On her behalf directly, and he ended up leaving out of the gym. I would say about maybe 5 to 10 minutes later, she came up to the team, and she didn't have to do this, but she expressed an apology for commanding that type of attention. But at the same time, she says, no one is going to come into my presence amongst myself and these young people is going to show the kind of disrespect towards me like he did. And, whew, man. Anyway, the head football coach, he said he went into the office about 10 minutes later to sign out. You know, at the end of the day, officially, and he can still hear her voice because it resulted in some kind of meeting in the office, in the front office, and he said he can still hear her basically speaking up for herself, so to speak, in some sort of closed meeting. And anyway, I'm kind of like, can't wait till I get a chance to speak with her come Monday afternoon. And that's my workplace racism experience. Thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. Black self-respect. Awesome. Awesome. And it sounds like from what you said, you don't have to be nasty. You don't have to curse and all of that.
Right.
You don't have to emulate
right.
the tackiness that they're doing. Just, you know, hey, we are going to behave professionally, and I'm not going to accept unprofessional behavior from anybody. You're going to be courteous in the way you talk to me. Certainly, if there's a problem, we can handle it, but we need to do things in a professional manner, and what you're exhibiting right now is not that, and it's totally unacceptable. Black self-respect right there.
And I don't think from the young people's clapping, I don't think it's just for them, you know, being sarcastic. They really got it. They really got it, and that's why you can't underestimate anybody. I'm not saying nobody on this particular program does, but you can't underestimate the age of a non-white victim of racial white supremacy and their ability to get it. And they saw it. They saw what you just said on a non-white black person. Not in a high emotional cursing, all that stomping around type of thing. I mean, just going right straight to the point on what they felt they needed to say in a constructive manner. And they literally stood up and applauded. I am not joking about this. That made my week. Thank you.
Spectacular. The female caller that I heard, were you going to share as well?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. If you could give us a bit more volume, that would be great.
Okay, hold on. Can you hear me a little bit better now?
That is an improvement.
Okay.
This is Princess again from New Orleans. I had just recently, really, I've just been struggling with as far as when it comes to workplace racism. You know, my store supervisor is a white male, and between the microaggressions and then trying to navigate with dealing with other confused victims. Basically, the other day, after I had spoke with another supervisor for our security detail because of an incident that had happened where this newer security guard called herself being discourteous to me. It was another black female, and I had to report it. She unfortunately was terminated, and I like I said, being in a management type role for me has been kind of hard. You know, like I said, on top of having to fight white people, you know, battle fatigue, you know, then having to turn around and fight other confused black people. And I don't know, it just kind of left me a bit down. And then at the same time, because of her overall demeanor when the incident occurred and because of the mentality of most black people out here, in New Orleans, you know, my dad was just worried about me just taking extra precaution when I'm leaving work and stuff, just to make sure that I'm, you know, safe and this, that, and the other. But it's just, hopefully I can make it back home to Florida soon. But it's just been stressful, and I didn't really know how to feel about it. You know, I tried to ignore the situation at first to, you know, in hopes that she would maybe be mature about it and just know that at the end of the day, we were both there to perform a job and that, you know, I wasn't going to be feeding into any Fifi kitty cat stuff. And it just seems like it's endemic of a lot of females here in particular. And so I don't know. But it's just, like I said, it's kind of gotten me a bit depressed. And, you know, because, you know, that's another, I guess you can call the victim who was not employed, and, you know, possibly, you know, has a family and stuff like that. And, but at the same time, you know, she was doing something that, could have gotten me in trouble. And I don't know.
Man, that is, glad you were able to share. That is super important. Anybody want to take the position that Princess is a coon and you know, she should be called out for her conduct? Anybody taking that position? All right, glad we didn't have that. But I mean, this is the system of white supremacy will put us victims in that sort of position all the time, particularly once you get the title as being a quote unquote supervisor. Where another victim of racism, all of us have been conditioned, anti-blackness is a huge problem, and just conflict in general, that's encouraged, cheered about, like, yes, we can go and be nasty to other people, and just incorrect behavior, non-constructive ways that we relate to people is just encouraged worldwide, and so you have these sort of problems. It can be really difficult. I know this has come up on the program many times in terms of how you deal with that, because it does happen a lot of times where non-white people are mistreating and doing incorrect things to other non-white people, and particularly in the workplace, how you deal with that sort of thing, and exactly the dilemma that you presented. You don't want to, this is another victim of racism. You don't want to see them having difficulties and not being able to support themselves, take care of their family and what have you. But at the end of the day, you are, this person is doing something that's incorrect, and it could impact me and have me in that situation where, you know, I'm not able to take care of myself, or it's causing me problems on the job. I know I'm always a big advocate of just being honest. I mean, you know, if it's getting to the point where it's, hey, I'm going to have to say something, it might mean that I might have to go and talk to a white person about this problem and get them involved to settle this conflict. And I mean, that's the type of thing that we really want to be trying to minimize as much as we can. If you can go to the person, if the communication is at least to the point where you can say, hey, I know we've had some problems, some issues. I really do not want to go and have to bring anybody else in. Hopefully we can just deal with this between us. What can we do to resolve this? And if we can't get it resolved between us, I am going to have to go and let them know that there's a problem and have them intervene to have them solve this problem. But this is the issue. Let's see if we can get it solved between us. And then, you know, if they're not willing. And I unfortunately have heard many times where victims of racism have done exactly that. And the victim that they were talking to, it didn't make a difference at all. It just continued with more conflict. And unfortunately, they did have to go get a white person to come, you know, resolve the situation. But I mean, it is a total ugly, horrendous dilemma. I can totally understand the stress that you're under. And again, whites are most to blame to that. They set up that sort of environment all the time. Generally, I would say they put black people in those type of quote-unquote supervisory positions just so that they can have squabbling and conflict among non-white people. Yeah, tough, isn't it? That's what you got to do. That's the job of supervisor. You got to get the colors in, get the colors in line. That's sort of exactly the sort of thing that they set up in the job. Folks have suggestions on how you would deal with that sort of situation?
I just want to say to the caller, I too understand your frustration and your pain, and I hear it in your voice. You have got to find a way to find the stress reliever for yourself, because I too am in that position that you are in the workplace, and you got to find something that will help you to depressurize, for lack of a better word. Otherwise, you are going to snap in your mental health, because it is a difficult plantation that we are on, and when we have it from other black people, it makes it just that more magnified. So find something that will allow you to find comfort and solace in yourself and to not be so stressed out.
I wanted to say, to piggyback off of the previous callers, what helps me is meditation, as far as de-stressing and helping to maintain a sense of calm. I think that might be helpful. One book that helped me quite a bit is the Mental Netta Volume 1 by Raul Neferiman. It has an in-depth meditation practice that might be helpful to you in regards to that, and then also regarding your safety, because I believe you said your father was concerned because of the incident. There's a book called Spy Secrets That Can Save Your Life by Jason Hansen. He is a former CIA agent who basically reveals information that spies utilize to maintain battlefield awareness, so that when you're out and about, you can kind of spot behavior that could be potentially dangerous to you before it happens, so that you can avoid those things. And he also provides techniques on how to protect yourself as well. But just the insight, because it's basically spy secrets he's revealed on techniques they use to maintain battlefield awareness and be aware of their surroundings. So maybe that might help you just as far as just being conscientious of who's around you, what's going on around you, and potentially being able to see something that is potentially dangerous to you before it happens, so you can remove yourself from that situation. And also, I have my own workplace observation, but I don't know if anyone else wanted to speak to her situation, so I'll give them the opportunity.
We'll make sure we get you in, Roz. I just wanted to add really quick, in case anybody else had anything. In my view, that is not snitching. What happened in Princess's situation, I know we talked about that before. That's in Mr. Fuller's code book. In my view, that is not snitching. That, in my view, that's the same logic. If someone steals your vehicle and you report it to the police, that's not snitching. Even the person is a black person that steals your vehicle, that's not snitching. If you're on the job and someone is doing incorrect things to you, if they're mistreating you directly or if they're just doing something that's incorrect and is causing you problems, and you're going to the person saying, hey, wait a minute, we have a problem here. We need to resolve this issue because, you know, this could end up becoming a concern for me, maybe even having a detrimental impact on my employment situation, and they continue to do it and are unwilling to bring this to some sort of resolution. That's not snitching. If you have to, if you make the decision, hey, I'm going to have to go and get some whites involved to solve this problem, that's not snitching at all, in my opinion.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening. This is an interesting situation, man, because I just don't know, like, exactly what was said or done to make, you know, the sister go that extra mile. I think that I'm not in a management position, but I've been in positions since I've started listening to the show and dealing with black people at work that, you know, we could have got in trouble and I might have put it into a context like, listen, you don't want to get to white people here, you know, let's just, you know, and everyone kind of gets that. But, man, that's a tough position to be in. And I can understand her pain because I would be sitting there thinking, man, you know, this is another black person without a job now, you know. My question to her is, does she think that the same outcome would have happened if the employee was white?
No. In fact, like I said earlier, they would make accommodations or excuses. But the crazy thing is that the security detail that our company uses is a black-owned business. They operate in 6 other states, and they just closed a deal with the sewage and water board here in New Orleans. So they had bought out another company, and basically the people that they're bringing in from the previous company that they've bought out, they basically have a zero-tolerance policy within their probationary period. And basically what had went down was the guard, for whatever reason, felt compelled to go to my assistant store manager and complain about me actually doing my job and leaving at a time that she wasn't accustomed to leaving because she saw other black supervisors who are able to do whatever they want. She assumed that me and my other team member of leadership, we were just leaving the store late just because we wanted to. And what she didn't realize was that she alerted management that this is why work isn't getting done, because they're leaving the store early and not finalizing stuff. So now you have a situation where the district manager has been at the store for the past 4 times within this week. They're looking at things that hasn't been done and implemented and stuff. And, you know, they're looking at, you know, the fact that, oh, well, because they're leaving early, this is why all these tasks and things that needed to be processed and done hasn't been getting done. And because of the security guard, which, you know, pretty much was complaining about something that had really nothing to do with anything. She also indicated that, you know, she doesn't get paid after 11 and that she, you know, said some other things that alerted her superiors, and they had to come and speak to her to let her know, you know, this is how we do things with our company. And so instead of taking it as a learning curve,
she basically came into work with animosity towards me and just being rude and discourteous. And like I said, at first, I just brushed it off until something else had happened a few days ago. I had called the
initial supervisor to give him a heads up. He took a report, had already talked to her, this, then other, he was trying to give her a chance and stuff, but basically, she didn't see me in another department where she had, she was speaking on the floor with other employees, basically trying to create animosity toward me because of something she had revealed to our management team. And, instead of being honest and saying, I accidentally said this to your store manager and now this is why you guys all have to leave out at the same time, which is actually our company policy for security. And, but she, is just going around saying all this stuff to employees to make, to villainize me. So as I was walking, she didn't realize, she didn't see where I was. And so when she had gotten up, she saw me, and then I just kindly and politely asked her, hey, look, don't be saying anything to my employees or, people on the floor about what your supervisor had talked to you in private, and I didn't even get to finish that. She was just being very rude and discourteous and stuff, so I had immediately just let her know, hey, I'm going to contact your supervisor, and she was just being nasty. Ghetto would be the perfect word for it. It seems like that's commonplace here. And so I just got her logbook, got the card to her supervisor and called, and that was it.
Yeah, I could imagine dealing with, how difficult it is probably to deal with people from New Orleans with the traumatic experiences they've gone through over the years. My philosophy on the workplace, unfortunately, it's been done to me, my people who I thought I was cool with, is that everyone's going to do what they need to do to keep their job. And, at the end of the day, you got to go home to somebody and see them. You got to do what you got to do. So I'm totally with whatever you did. If you're in a management position, you shouldn't be taking disrespect. Because I guarantee you she wouldn't have came in and treated no white person like that. But she already knew what would have happened. So it is what it is.
Just my thought would be, from what you just described, that sort of, if that's the way she was conducting herself in the workplace, it sounds like that sort of thing was bound to happen eventually anyway. If that was the way she was behaving in the workplace, that she was going to have some problems regardless, whether it's with another black person, a white person, whatever the case may be. I think that situation came up with Thomas, where he had Thomas in New York, where it was a black female on the job, and she was talking about her disdain for black people and that sort of thing out publicly, and we talked about it on the program, and just saying that, particularly today with the type of environment that they have in the workplace, if you're conducting yourself in that manner, it's just going to be a matter of time before whites say, oh, this is an easy person that we can get rid of today. We're having cutbacks or whatever other phraseology that they want to use. Boop, we'll put this person's name at the top of the list of folks who can get their last paycheck and we can be done with them. Before I get Ross, he said he had a workplace situation he wanted to share. Did I call in the Bay Area? Did you say you had workplace racism you wanted to share as well, or am I just making up things?
No, I did. Sorry. I did. Whenever you have a moment.
We have a moment. Let's hear it.
Okay. So I'm at work. So, I just started the new job with the black nail spa. And there's a masseuse. She's black. She's an esthetician. And there's a hairstylist. Everyone's black except for maybe Spanish manicurist and the electrolysis is Caucasian. Her name is Judy. So I met her last Saturday, and I just said hi. I thought she was a client, a customer. So I just said hi about my business, but I noticed that she had been checking me out. And that's it. The only thing I said to her was hi, and I don't even look at her. I just keep on going about my business. So today, I guess she works on Saturdays. So today, now mind you, since I've been there, my job is to actually manage this business that is unmanaged. So the Caucasian lady decides that she's going to speak to me. And it maybe took a couple of hours for her to speak to me because I don't acknowledge her existence. I just keep on going. So she's like, I haven't officially met you. What's your name? Are you Natasha? And I say, yeah, uh-huh. So, hi, nice to meet you. So I said, hi, and I just kept on flying around. So apparently, I clean up in there. So I'm in the kitchen cleaning something because there's a lot of things going on, hair, nails, all kind of stuff is going on in this kitchen area. So the lady, she just stopped me and said, what are you doing? Is that cleaning detergent? I smell cleaning detergent. What did you just use? So I clean the sink with a disinfectant because there's so many different things going on in the sink. So after I use it, I always disinfect it. So she's, oh, my God, I can't breathe. Oh, I can't think. I don't know what to do. So then she comes back with this mask on. It's really carrying on. So I said, well, what do you mean? Oh. And so the owner of the actual salon was like, oh, I forgot to tell you that she's allergic to chemicals. Wow! And she's in this big old scene and carrying on. So I'm just looking like, oh my bad. Like, now the dish rack is dirty. I'm the only one that cleans up in here. I know you're the new cleaning lady. And I thought, oh, hold on. I'm not the cleaning lady. Oh, well, what I'm saying is I'm allergic to this products, and I just can't take these products. And, so I'm just looking now because she's very overwhelming. So now this lady is following me around this facility, just following me around. What did you just use? What did you do? I'm like, oh, my God, you're like a terrorist. Could you back up off me? You just said that you're allergic to these products. I won't use them. I don't know. Whatever you want to use, just let me know. Well, she should have told you that. I bought all this natural green stuff. What did you just use? I said, look here, lady. I said I will refrain from using whatever. Just whatever you won't use, just leave it out. And she's like, throw all that away. Throw this away. So now, mind you, what she's throwing away is what the owner just purchased because I told her we were running out of supplies. So this big bottle of Lysol, lemon scent, she wants that gone. And it's all this stuff. And now she's poking at me. She's really poking at me because I'm not looking at her. So she's poking at me. And I'm still doing it. Now the dish rag is, look, I use vinegar and water to clean. And I just looked at her. So then she keeps reiterating how this is what she uses, and she uses green tea solution, and all this other stuff that she uses, natural cleaning stuff. So I said, well, okay, just let me know what's going on. Just let me know. I can't take all these different instructions. There's too many different instructions. And so now this lady, I'm going into the another area. She's following me around. Look, I don't want you to feel bad. I don't feel bad. I'm just trying to get over to what I have to do. So now she's following me all over the place. What did you use? What is it? All these chemicals. Hey, look here, lady. Go talk to the owner because you're terrorizing me now. So she's literally following me, poking at me. Look, I hope I didn't offend you or anything because you really didn't know. She should have told you I'm allergic. I said, look, this is just too much pressure for me. I have to go. Well, no, don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. Come, don't go anywhere. So I just left, and I had to take a time out. So when I came back, the owner and another co-owner had said something to her. So now they asked the masseuse, which is she looks like she's a little older than all of us, and her she's a little more stern. So she ended up coming back, and she was explaining to her what happened. She said, look, well, you guys are going to have to tell her, nip it in the bud. She's like, you got to tell her. If she doesn't like the way what's going on right now, she could find her somewhere else to be. She doesn't have to be here. She's like, because I'm not going to be nice to her. So if you can't say that or if anyone else can say it, that's what I'm going to say. So now she ended up him and the Caucasian lady up about her tyrant. So now the Caucasian lady, well, I don't know what she sprayed. And she's just going off and going off. So I was trying to hide from her for a little while. I mean, I still have to end up back in the kitchen because I'm always in the kitchen. So she's like, well, I know you're the cleaning lady and you clean, but I usually clean. And I just want to say, if I hurt your feelings, I'm just, come here. I said, look, lady, I got stuff to do. I'm not tripping. Just get whatever products you want to clean. Just please.
So now she's following me around again. Just come here. Come here. Give me a hug. I really feel bad. I was crying. I was crying because I felt bad for you. I was like, don't feel bad for me. I'm not tripping. You are the one that has this disorder. I'm not tripping. Well, no, there's people. And then she's just going on and on and on. So now she's taking the products and pouring them down the drain. So I'm like, wait, don't pour anything down the drain. We can take it home. Well, no, I'm allergic, and people shouldn't even be bringing this stuff in anyway. And then so I walk away. I come back. All the products are down the drain and the recycled bin has the containers. So I said, I told the owner. She's like, oh, no, I know she's not throwing my stuff away. So it turned into that. But we're in a business, so we can't, you know, just pop off. So he said, well, you know what? Look, we'll just deal with this later. So now the Caucasian lady is following me around again, and she's like, stop, wait. And then somebody's like, who are you talking to? And then she comes following me again. Can I just have a hug? Can I just have a hug? And you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to buy all new products. And don't clean the table or the dish or the counter or anything, because I'll do it. And I'm just like, okay, that's fine. But I just want, that was just so overwhelming for me, because white people are just like terrorists. So if you don't pay them any attention, they're going to find a way to get your attention, because you don't ignore them, they ignore you. You don't tune me out, I tune you out. And look here, cleaning lady. And, you know, they're just so disrespectful and vile. So I just had to get that off, because it just happened a couple of hours ago, and I was just so, So, okay, that's all. Thank you.
Wow. That, great illustration. It seems like you've had quite a few incidents dealing with race soldiers on the job, where you've had to employ just being disciplined and whatever they're doing, not getting emotional and just being very disciplined in how you respond to their antics. And again, that's something that I encourage folks to do consistently, and particularly once it gets to the physical contact thing, once they have gone into whatever they're doing, and then it's, oh, let's resolve things, let's kiss and make up, let me have that. Let's just proceed. I have things to do. You have tasks to do. Let's just move forward with our day. Just keep it business. No emotions involved. I already know who I'm dealing with, and keep it moving. And I think that's solid observation as well about the way that whites respond. Like, wait a minute, this nigger is ignoring me. I'm supposed to be ignoring them, not the other way around. And really making an effort to get your attention once they see that you have just kind of minimized them. I'm not going to devote a whole lot of my time and energy to you. I'm about my tasks and doing other things, and I'm not even paying you any regard. It's been my experience, white people really pay attention to that, because that they are just not accustomed to that from the system of racism, white supremacy, how they've groomed non-white people to behave. Roz, you were going to share, I guess this will be our last one before we wrap up. Roz, you were going to share workplace racism?
Yes, thank you. All I could think of was narcissistic, psychopathic, sociopathic. Unbelievable, but you handled it very, very well. My workplace racism observation, this past Thursday, I was on the phone with a member. I worked for a healthcare company, and essentially I helped her with whatever the situation was she was dealing with her healthcare. And she brought up something. She's the first white person I've talked to who had anything positive to say about President Obama. She said, oh, you know, I really like President Obama. She said, I'm not too enamored with some of the aspects of the Affordable Care Act, but I know that this is not Obama's fault. She said, what irked me is a lot of people talk about Obama and blame him for what's going on, but actually the Affordable Care Act was an act that was originally was attempted by Bob Dole in 1994, when Hillary Clinton, back in that time frame, was trying to come up with, I guess, her variation of universal health care. And Bob Dole was basically the opponent, and the plan that he wanted to move forward with was essentially what is now the Affordable Care Act. So she said, it really irks me when people always blame Obama for everything, and you know, I hear this all the time, and I have to actually educate them on the fact that it's the Republicans who actually put this policy forward in the first place. And I was just like, wow, you know, we're just talking, and she's going on giving me the history behind what happened and all of this stuff. And then
I just happened to ask her. I said, well, hey, have you ever seen Michael Moore's documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story? So she says no, and I tell her the premise of the movie, and of the documentary, and that essentially Michael Moore ended up taking a bunch of people who were working at 9/11 site and basically contracted different forms of cancer to Cuba, and they got all of the health care they couldn't get in the United States for free in Cuba. And she was like, wow, you know, she's talking. And she just said, well, yeah, anyway, I just wanted to say that, you know, Obama's doing the best job he can, and ultimately, you know, I wish a lot more people were educated so they would stop blaming him for everything. And I found that just fairly fascinating, because I've gotten tons and tons of comments about vote for Donald Trump and, you know, Obama's the worst thing that ever happened to this country. And for once, I got a white person who had something positive to say and was actually educated about it and wanted to spread that education. So that was a very interesting observation. I don't think she's a cool white person. If we had 1,000 more of her, the problem of racism, white supremacy would be solved. I just found it interesting to find a white person who was on the opposite end of the understanding of what healthcare is really all about and has something positive to say about the president. So I don't know what anyone else's take might be on that, but I just found that interesting, and that was a workplace observation. The other thing was in reference to the situation with the location that my company is opening up in Arizona, I'm finding that there's quite a few people as far as senior team leads and also supervisors who are trying to make provisions to transfer over to Arizona. So that's giving me a lot of signs. And then a lot of people who are actually in the member services department have been departing and finding jobs. So it seems like there's an undercurrent of people that understand that coming down the road, the plantation is going to do some cleansing of people on the job, and it's going to probably be non-white faces, specifically black faces. So they seem to be making, some of them making that transition early, and I'm just keeping my eyes open for what's happening on the job, but I'm just noticing the consensus about people attempting to transfer over to Arizona, and then other people are just basically leaving before anything goes down. And that's my workplace racism observation. Thank you very much.
Fascinating. Wow. I could just, with the white women really quick, white people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. It's been my experience that even a lot of the white people who complain about President Obama, they know that he is not in charge. They are knowledgeable, whether it's talking about Obamacare or many. I even heard some of the white people who didn't support the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, didn't support it, but they came out and said, like, hey, we cannot be associated with anything that that nigger does, even if I think it might be beneficial. No way. I oppose it just because it's him. I can't be in any way, shape, form associated or even look like I might be halfway in agreement with anything that comes out of that nigger's mouth. And they'll even run down like, yeah, this would be really beneficial. Great policy, blah, blah, blah. And Mitt Romney had a similar policy when he was governor, blah, blah, blah. They can run down all those details. At the end of the day, white people are not ignorant about racism, white supremacy. They're certainly not ignorant about President Obama, even the nonsense when they were talking about they didn't know enough about him and he came from nowhere. And who is this guy? He wasn't standard operating procedure. Just a lot of white people, like the female that you described, it's a lot of those type of folks up here in Washington State. I've heard them, you know, chatting away for the last few years now, saying a lot of similar things, even though they might even throw in, I don't particularly like what he's done, but, you know, hey, what can he do? They understand the power dynamics very well. With that,
we amen.
With that, we should be here Monday. Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson returns to the program. It'll be great to hear his thoughts, on, particularly with the suspension report that we heard. A lot of people were talking about that. Normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should also be here on Tuesday. We should have a second program this month for black parents, specifically education about the significance, strategies if you're looking at homeschooling, and other things that black parents should be thinking about in terms of your child's educational development. We should be here Tuesday. Dr. Mazama, hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. She's an educator in Pennsylvania who's written a lot about this subject matter. She even had some articles written in the Washington Post. Thursday, we should be here a white woman. She wrote a fascinating book about lynchings as a public spectacle and about the whole act of killing and mutilating black bodies. and the significance of having pictures and photographs and making a whole public display about all of this. And the interesting thing was when I pitched the invitation for her to come on the program, I connected her scholarship to a lot of our current observations. I think Roz and many others, super scholar and the extra gorgeous Isabel Wilkerson. She wrote Warmth of Other Suns. She wrote a tremendous piece about 2 years ago where she was talking about all these police videos, the dash cam videos and what have you, of black people being killed and shot and choked and everything else. And she related that to lynching photographs. And I pitched that to her in the invitation. I even included some of the spectacles that have been happening at these Trump rallies where black people have been getting assaulted and abused. And then the police don't even come and get the perpetrator. They come and get, you know, the black person and handcuff them and take them off, and saying this seems very similar, the same sorts of racist rituals. And she was like, wow, that is fascinating. I'm so interested in coming. And so we'll see how honest she's willing to be. But that's Thursday, the 28th of April. So we should be here. We won't be here tomorrow, but we should be here Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and then picking back up Friday with Medical Apartheid, Harriet Washington, segment number two, Active April for the Cows. Folks have questions, gripes, complaints, suggestions. You can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. I was able to find, Thomas in New York was talking, I was able to find the report that just substantiated what he was talking about with Prince's court settlement, where he began regaining the rights to his catalog, enormous catalog of music. Talk about body of work. I posted that, and it was almost 2 years to the day when he died. That is extremely significant. John Patash, he was on our program just a couple weeks ago. He has that in both of his books, talking about the timing of when black people die. He talked about this with Huey P. Newton. He talked about this with Martin Luther King. Quite a few other art, even Tupac Shakur, the timing of when either they died or a shooting or something violent happening to a black person. If it is timed with something, particularly if they said something or did something to try to counter racism, white supremacy, and then a year from that time or 2 years from that time, they end up dying or something of that nature, that he has seen a long pattern of that. And it seems to be suggesting a message that you niggers shouldn't do this. Dr. King dying a year after he gave his speech against the Vietnam War. You niggers shouldn't be doing this. With Prince, you niggers shouldn't be doing this, trying to battle racists who dominate the entertainment field. Also, Forbes had a great report. I posted it. I put it on my Twitter as well as the Facebook page. It's titled, What's the Evidence Behind Reports of Prince's Percocet Overdose? I thought that was a really important post, because I too had been seeing a lot of posts that saying he might have overdosed. And I had kind of the same question, like, where is the evidence? That it's very, very easy to just say, oh, another dead nigger. You know, that's what they do, the drugs. And that's all of the black folks. That's all that they're good for, taking drugs and, you know, doing a little booty shaking, where black people are just not taken seriously. This is someone, Prince, who was extremely intelligent, the musical genius, undeniable, but was extremely smart in the way that he went about managing his career, and very outspoken also about racism, white supremacy, things that were happening to him and his observations. Great report I would encourage folks to check out with just the first paragraph. It reads, after reports circulated yesterday that the flu may have led to Prince's death, new stories are surfacing that he overdosed on Percocets during an airplane flight a week prior to his death. According to TMZ, the overdose led to his becoming unresponsive and an emergency landing of the plane. It is important to emphasize that no medical personnel or health officials have verified any of these reports, including reports of Prince having the flu. So until formal autopsy and review of medical records occurs, everything will likely be speculation, could just be out and out lies, further practice of racism, white supremacy. I thought that was really important. Folks can check it out at Forbes.com. It's on my Facebook page. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Certainly would encourage folks, you do not want to be purchasing any of the poisons, chemicals that racists provide. We want to be about being clear so that we can make fabulous decisions under this condition of white terrorism. If you are going to be driving, passenger, pedestrian, certainly if you're driving, you do not want to be intoxicated. You never know when it'll be Daniel Pantaleo, Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw, any of these other race soldiers who pulls up behind you, you want to be able to make phenomenal decisions. If you're under the influence, you are just making their job exponentially easier to terrorize, even take your life, and anybody that might be with you at that particular time. Certainly you want to buckle up. If you're in a vehicle, let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with enforcement officials and just whites, period. Whether they have a badge or not, they are extraordinarily dangerous. With that, we'll be back in 48 hours. Again, drop an email if you have questions, problems, gripes, complaints, untiljustice@gmail.com. Caller who is going to do the prayer to wrap us up, proceed.
Thank you, Gus, callers and speakers, for your constructive comments. I believe all of the constructive comments this evening were helpful to our mental health. Creator, some black people do not understand that we are in a system of racism, white supremacy. And then you gave us Dr. Francis Cress Welsing to help us to understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, and how it works. Dr. Welsing helped us to understand that all of the colors of black people are beautiful, and crystal black people are the most beautiful. She taught us self-respect and how to respect other black people. She embodied the highest form of self-respect and love for black people in her actions and behavior. Creator, thank you for Dr. Francis Cress Welsing in my lifetime. Creator, help black people to understand that white people practice racism, white supremacy in all areas of people activities, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. Creator, help black people to systematically transform their behavior for the purpose of justice and to guarantee that no black person is mistreated and to guarantee that the black person that needs help the most gets the most constructive help. Creator, help black people to speak, understand, and to practice this sacred mantra daily. Stop allowing racism, white supremacy to divide us. Stop being discourteous to each other. Stop cursing each other. Stop disrespecting each other. Stop fighting each other. Stop gossiping about each other. Stop killing each other. Stop name-calling each other. Stop clowning with sex, because an unwanted child is not a laughing matter. Stop pretending that racism, white supremacy does not exist. Stop robbing each other. Stop using drugs. Stop selling drugs to each other. Stop snitching to each other, to white people for personal gain. Stop squabbling with each other. Stop stealing from each other. Stop throwing trash where black people live, work, play, and pray. Start making time to study and understand racism, white supremacy daily. Creator, help black people to erase racism, white supremacy, and to replace it with justice immediately.
Ashe. Context of White Supremacy, signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.